Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The clerk will call this morning's calendar. We'll proceed initially hearing from Mr. Minter.
May it please the court, Shannon Minter on behalf of the Strauss petitioners. This court's decision in the marriage cases is a resounding and eloquent affirmation of our Constitution's foundational guarantee of equal citizenship. It is today's case that will determine whether future generations of Californians can continue to count on that guarantee.
Well, let me ask you this as a threshold question apart from the three formally presented questions posed by the grant of review. The United States and California Supreme Courts over the years have recognized a right to marry, a constitutional right to marry, and of course the effect of this court's decision in the marriage cases was to extend that to same-sex couples. Now, there are many things that were held in that particular ruling, including the application of the suspect classification to sexual orientation, submitting that to strict scrutiny and so forth, and of course the nomenclature, the terminology of marriage. You and the other petitioners seem to take the position, in order to buttress your argument, that this is in fact an impermissible revision, impermissible because it was not placed on the ballot by the legislature, instead by the initiative process. You seem to take that position on the premise that all or most of the holdings, including those protections that I just described, were superseded by Proposition 8. Now, that, I suppose, puts you in a somewhat ironic or maybe even contradictory position, because to the extent that Proposition 8 is to be construed narrowly, perhaps changing only the terminology or the name of the institution and not doing anything with regard to these other rights, your argument that this is a wholesale revision as opposed to an amendment is weakened. So how do you deal with that seeming dichotomy?
Well, 2 points. Let me make clear that the petitioners in no way suggest that Proposition 8 countermanded this court's holding that sexual orientation is a suspect classification and that a person's sexual orientation is not a legitimate basis for depriving them of legal rights. Petitioner's position is that Proposition 8 took away the fundamental right to marry from same-sex couples.
The right to marry or the right to get married?
Took away the fundamental freedom to marry, which includes the choice, constitutionally protected choice about whether and whom to marry, and the ability to continue in that relationship.
Is it your position that there can be no limitations on the right to marry?
No.
There are limitations.
Yes, as this court held in the marriage decisions, in the marriage cases, yes.
Counsel, in what way does Proposition 8 take anything away other than the nomenclature of marriage?
Well, as this court's decision made powerfully clear, relegating same-sex couples to domestic partnership does not provide them with everything but a word. It puts those couples in a second-class status. It marks them as second-class citizens. It deprives them of equal liberty, dignity, and privacy.
But didn't that holding point out that the underlying premise of that particular argument was based on the label marriage? This is just to follow up on a question that the Chief Justice asked at the outset. Are you disagreeing that in our decision last year in the marriage cases, among the issue of the label of marriage, a majority of this court, I thought, came up with some important holdings? You already alluded to that. The majority of this court said that sexual orientation was a suspect classification. The opinion talked about the higher standard of review, strict scrutiny. Is it your argument in this proceeding that the passage of Prop 8 also took away, in addition to the label of marriage, the core of the substantive rights of marriage that the majority of this court outlined in the marriage cases last year?
It took away one of the core elements, which, as this court made crystal clear in the marriage cases, is the right to be treated with equal dignity and respect, the right to have an official recognition of one's family relationship that is of equal stature and dignity to the recognition given to opposite sex couples.
And this, what about the other rights, though, that go beyond the mere designation? And in answering that, what significance, if any, do you put to the rebuttal argument in the ballot materials against Proposition 8, which stated, your yes vote on Proposition 8 means that only marriage between a man and a woman will be valid or recognized in California, but Prop 8 will not, and that is capitalized in the materials, will not take away any other rights or benefits of gay couples. Is there any significance to that in the context of the legal issues that we're faced with today?
There's certainly practical significance for same-sex couples. In terms of the constitutional question before the court, no. The components, the substantive elements, protected elements of the right to marry are, as this court held in the marriage cases, organically intertwined and interrelated. Marriage is not just the mechanical sum of those component parts. If you remove any of those core components, you affect all of the other components. You end up with a different institution in a way that makes a very profound difference in the actual lives of the participants.
Assuming that the initiative only deprives same-sex couples of the nomenclature of marriage and doesn't affect in any way all the substantive rights that are pertinent thereto, assuming for the moment that that's the case, would you explain to the court why that is a revision to the state constitution rather than a mere amendment?
It is not possible, in petitioner's view, to excise the equality component of the fundamental right to marry or any other fundamental right. A fundamental right that is somehow stripped or shorn of the requirement that by definition all the substantive components of that right must be made equally available.
Based on our past jurisprudence, why, even taking into account what you were just telling the court, why that is a revision of the Constitution? How do you define a revision?
What Proposition 8 accomplishes, if it were upheld, is to establish a constitutional principle that a majority can take away a fundamental right only from the members of a group defined by a suspect classification, that is, only from the members of a group that have suffered a history of discrimination based on a characteristic that has absolutely no relevance to their ability to participate in society.
Has this court previously spoken to what constitutes a revision, and if so, would you tell us what the principle seems to be?
Yes, this court has a small but significant body of case law addressing the constitutional distinction between revision and amendment. The court has made it clear that a measure that is relatively simple and short can have a significant impact on the structure of our Constitution and the framework of our government, that an amendment has to be consistent, a measure that is consistent with the existing purposes, principles, structure of our Constitution, and the revision is a measure that substantially changes the existing purposes.
And would you connect your argument to that rule or that principle?
Yes. Proposition 8 changes the basic nature of our government from one in which majorities are prohibited from infringing on the rights of minorities.
In making that argument, I presume you're relying on the two-part test that this court has established in determining whether a particular initiative is an amendment or a revision. And presumably you would agree that in determining whether an initiative is a revision, we first ask, is it quantitative? Does it have lots of words? For instance, in one case, I think the initiative had 22,000 words and the Constitution at that time had 50,000 plus words. I presume that you would readily agree that in this particular case, this court shouldn't be concerned with the quantitative part of the test. We're dealing with 14 words in the initiative.
Petitioners have not advanced the argument that Proposition 8 is a quantitative revision. I would note, though, that there are numerous equality provisions all through the California Constitution, as well as an animating, pervasive sort of
getting to the core of the issue in this particular case. Let's, for purposes of oral argument, leave aside the quantitative part of the test. As I pointed out, we're dealing with 14 words, and at least as I view it, these 14 words do not substantially alter the nature of our state constitution, nor do they affect the basic structure of government in California. Let's deal with the qualitative part of the revision test. What is the test that this court, over a number of decades, has established in determining whether or not a qualitative test, a part of the revision test, is met?
The court looks at whether a measure changes the structure of the Constitution or the basic framework of our government. And that is exactly what Proposition 8 does. Our government is based on the principle not just of majority rule, but equally so on the limit that majorities must always respect minority rights. That balance between majority rule and minority rights is recognized across the world as the genius, as the defining hallmark of our democratic system. That check on the power of the majority is every bit just as essential to our democracy as the principle of majority rule.
Counsel, have our cases been limited to changes in government structure, ceding judicial power to the U.S. Supreme Court, or changing methods of taxation? Have there been any cases that in this amendment revision context that focus on the diminution or elimination of personal rights?
Not directly, no.
Is that necessarily precluded by our case law that deals with government structure or government plan?
No, not at all. I mean, I would note that in Raven, one aspect of the court's holding was the diminution of a significant number of rights for criminal defendants. And in Livermore versus Waite, the courts established the defining framework and held, and it's still good law, that amendment it cannot change the core underlying principles of our Constitution. But I do want to stress that in petitioner's view, Proposition 8 does change the foundational powers of the branches.
But can you distinguish the case of People versus Frierson?
Absolutely. When a majority changes the substantive scope of a fundamental right for all people, that does not interfere with the court's ability to enforce that right. It does not interfere or disturb the notion that there's such a thing as fundamental rights that limit government power. The same is not true for an amendment that purports to take away the protection of equal protection for a suspect class.
Well, let me ask you this then. Let's just say the marriage cases had gone the other way and the persons who are now petitioners had lost, and yet the gay rights movement had succeeded in having an initiative measure placed before the people, and the people had adopted it, extending the right to marriage to same-sex couples. And let's just say at the next election, opponents of gay marriage succeeded in placing an initiative on the ballot to reverse what the first initiative had done. Is it your position that the first initiative extending the right of marriage to same-sex couples could properly be effectuated by way of an amendment, but that the very same subject matter by way of a repeal 2 years later would, because it removes rights, have to be effected by way of revision rather than amendment?
Yes, but not because of the subject matter, because the test under Article 18 is, does a measure change the structure of our government?
But are you saying it's a one-way street when you say yes, that you can extend rights by way of amendment, but you can take them away only by way of revision? The same rights?
No, I'm suggesting that is not the, in, under this court's jurisprudence, the appropriate legal test. That what the court has to be looking at in determining whether a measure is an amendment or revision, does it change the very nature of our basic government? Does it change the structure and purposes of our Constitution? It's perfectly consistent with our existing Constitution for the people to decide to extend rights, to create new rights, to expand or limit the scope of existing rights. That in itself does not change the structure of our government or the relationship between majorities and the Equal Protection Clause and the court's judicial role in enforcing equal protection. But because the very nature of equal protection, its primary purpose is to protect historically disadvantaged minorities, for a mere majority to be able to remove a suspect class from the protection of equal protection, the equal protection requirement, disables both the equal protection guarantee itself, and materially it defeats the court's ability to play its role, its core constitutional role in enforcing equal protection. That is not true when majorities simply alter or change the substantive scope of a fundamental right. Equal protection in this context should not be understood just as a particular discrete right. It is an animating requirement that pervades the whole Constitution and pervades the enforcement of every other fundamental right in our Constitution.
Did I understand you to say that an amendment could change the substantive scope of equal protection right?
Yes.
Well, then why, in this case, is not the mere removal of the privilege of nomenclature of marriage just altering the substantive scope of a fundamental right which remains in place?
Because it's not the nomenclature is not the point. The point is the equality requirement. This court held in the marriage cases that it may or may not be required by the fundamental right to marry to provide the word marriage to everyone, but that what is indisputably essentially required is that the same term and status be applied equally to preserve that essential integral requirement of the fundamental right to marry that's part of every fundamental right, that by definition it has to apply equally to all persons.
Would this court have the authority, in your view, to say, based on the principles that you're espousing, that everybody that's married by the state is going to have a civil union and none of it can be called marriage, and if you want your union to be called marriage, you can go to your place of faith where they have the sacrament of marriage?
That would not run afoul of the limiting principle that the petitioners have put forward to this court. The core of our argument is that a simple majority cannot be permitted to take away rights from a historically disadvantaged minority without thereby substantially altering the very operation and purpose of equal protection and the court's ability to fulfill its core constitutional function of enforcing equal protection.
Counsel, whether accomplished by amendment, initiative amendment, or revision, is it your position that a substantive right such as equal protection can never have a limited exception?
No, absolutely not. This court has permitted substantive amendments to equal protection, but what it has never permitted and what has never happened before in the history of our state is an amendment that purports to take away the protection of the equal protection guarantee for a suspect class with regard to a fundamental right.
So all those ingredients have to be satisfied?
Yes, because the concerns here are the same concerns, the serious process-based concerns that underlie this court's strict scrutiny doctrine in the equal protection context.
What do you make, then, of the explicit exception to the Equal Protection Clause, Article 1, Section 7, that provides and bestows equal protection and due process rights, and then proceeds with a proviso that indicates that there may nonetheless be no public school assignment or transportation, i.e. busing? That was actually written into the Equal Protection Clause as an exception carved out of it. Now, aside from one's feelings about that, how does that jive with your argument in terms of not carving out exceptions to basic fundamental rights that protect certain individuals here, racial minorities, presumably with the beneficiaries intended of the busing provisions?
Well, that's very different. As the U.S. Supreme Court said when it was analyzing that provision, it is neutral with regard to any suspect classification. It did not actually limit the substantive scope of equal protection. It didn't alter this court's holding that there's greater protection under our state equal protection clause for racial discrimination than under the federal, that it simply eliminated one particular remedy. It's a very different situation than taking away a fundamental right only from a particular...
Mr. Minter, I'm afraid your time is up, but of course you've saved 5 minutes for rebuttal, and we will hear now from Mr. Marshall, Amicus Curiae, Asian Pacific American Legal Center. Mr. Marshall.
May it please the Court, Raymond Marshall, counsel for MIKI, five of the leading civil rights organizations in California. This case is critical to the amici and the civil rights community. Proposition 8 is not just about the rights of gays and lesbians to marry. It creates a radically new rule that political majorities can deprive targeted minorities of fundamental rights.
It cannot be... Mr. Marshall, to follow up on the beginning of your argument, I gather that, well, at least based upon what I just heard, you share the views of the other attorneys on the one side of the proceeding here, those challenging the validity of Prop 8, where the argument in common, so to speak, is basically this. Proposition 8, according to your view, represents an unprecedented instance in which a majority of the voters of California have altered California's constitution so as to diminish the constitutional rights of a minority group. Well, it would appear that there are various groups that could be considered disfavored or unpopular. What comes to mind to me is a group of criminal defendants. And I think that it was Justice Chin who earlier asked the question about this court's decision in People versus Frierson. You may recall that in People versus Frierson, this court upheld an initiative by the voters of California that shortly after this court's decision in Anderson, and Anderson held that the death penalty was cruel or unusual punishment. Well, shortly thereafter, the voters of California lost no time to disagree with that particular court's decision and say, we want the death penalty in California, it would appear to me that life is, at least in my view, a fundamental right. Do you take a different view?
No, I don't.
The right to life and the right to defend one's life?
No, not at all.
And yet, in People v. Frierson, where this court dealt with a fundamental right, the right to life, this court concluded that the people have the right to initiative. Well, that's, of course, established. But beyond that, this court said that particular initiative, restoring the death penalty in California, was not a revision. There are other cases which I won't bother to mention in the interest of time. Given these precedential values that have been established by this court in previous decisions, how do you distinguish those previous decisions from this particular initiative where the people of California, in essence, took away the label of marriage, but, as has been pointed out by the Chief Justice and other members of the bench, it left intact most of what this court declared to be proper under the California Constitution?
And, Mr. Marshall, before you respond to that, I might add that in People v. Anderson, the case that the initiative was aimed at, the court said that the death penalty was, and I'll quote, unnecessary to any legitimate goal of the state and is incompatible with the dignity of man and the judicial process. So that was People v. Anderson, followed by the initiative, and then followed by Frierson. So if you could respond in that context.
Certainly. First, amici do not contend that there is any lesser value, obviously, to the right to life as to equal protection. Frierson, however, can be distinguished in many respects. First and foremost, Frierson, in restoring the death penalty, did not do so selectively. Frierson was not a case where it was ruled that the death penalty would only apply to one segment of California citizens. It did not say the death penalty will be applied and reinstated as only to African Americans, only to Hispanic Americans, or one group. It reestablished the death penalty across the board for all California citizens.
If we were to agree with you, solely assuming what I just said for the purposes of oral argument right now, if we were to agree with you, would that affect the validity of the death penalty in California, or would it just create a huge problem as to whether or not the number of people that have been sent to death since the Frierson decision were properly executed?
No, not at all. There's no tension between the rule that amici proposed versus the court's holding in Frierson. In Frierson, again, it was restoring the death penalty to across the board without any selective classification.
But more importantly, Counsel, Frierson, which was a plurality opinion, it seems to me, the way I read Frierson anyway, on the amendment revision issue that we're discussing here, it seems that the court there focused on the fact that the Supreme Court, our court, still retained broad judicial powers of review. So in that sense, we were not altering the form of government structure or the role of this particular court. It seems to me that's a stronger argument. I agree with you that in the sense that the constitutional right against cruel, unusual punishment, like all criminal laws, apply to all of us. And it's not a particular group is not being selected out for application of those laws. But it seems to me the stronger argument is that Frierson on its face didn't deal with the elimination of constitutional personal rights.
That's perfectly correct. And in addition, in Frierson, one can say that it did stay within the parameters or within the framework of the Constitution. That is, it did not seek to take away the power of the court. to be able to look at individual cases or the rule on the death penalty. What Proposition 8 does, and what Amici contend, is that this is a case which, for the first time, a ballot initiative has been used to take away a fundamental right from a suspect class. That is more than just a structural change. Going to the Court's earlier question to Mr. Mentor with regards to quantitative versus qualitative analysis with regards to revision versus amendment, it is Amici's position that for the first time, Proposition 8, if left unchallenged and is left as law, the end result is that there is no principal difference between being able to take away the rights of gays and lesbians to marry than to be able to take away the right of any other minority with regard to any other particular right.
Let me ask you this. It seems that what your argument really boils down to is a practical but perhaps more political than legal matter is this, to put it in plain words, that it is just too easy to amend the California Constitution. Now, whatever views we may have toward that, then one may very well be sympathetic as a criticism of the current status. California's Constitution, unlike some of the other states, is set up in a way that does not do what other states do. It does not require a supermajoritarian vote of the electorate. It does not put certain rights, inalienable rights, off limits to amendment by initiative. To pick an extreme example, in Massachusetts, you have to get clearance by a certain percentage of the legislature for two successive legislative sessions in a row to even put something before the voters. And when the Constitution Revision Commission in 1962 did a study, they found that California's Constitution had been amended 362 times by then. Now it's more than 500 times, and at that time it was more than any other state except Louisiana. Contrast that to the U.S. Constitution that's been amended only 27 times in a much longer history. Isn't that basically what you were complaining of? And maybe the solution has to be a political one where the Constitution is amended, but the fact is there have been initiatives that have restricted and taken away rights of minorities put forth by majority vote. Maybe that shouldn't be the case, but isn't that the system that we have to live with unless and until it's changed?
No. Amici's argument is not one which is political. Amici's argument is one which is legal and found within the Constitution. Mr. Mentor spoke about the analysis of amendment versus revision. Revision is within the Constitution, Article 18. When you look to the Constitution and you look to the cases, starting with Legislature v. U, the analysis is if it's outside the parameters, if it's a fundamental restructuring, if it's going to change the laws in a fundamental way and the branches of government in a fundamental way, that itself is a revision. That is not an amendment.
Well, what, labeling it as resulting in a fundamental change of the law, that's a very broad way of putting it. Can you make a more detailed argument?
Yes, there's nothing more fundamental than the Equal Protection Doctrine. When minorities over the years have been deprived of their rights, or that is the right to vote, the right to education, the right to marry the person of their choice, as the right of gays and lesbians have been deprived by
what about the argument that, and this goes back to questions that were asked earlier by the bench, what about the argument, to which I would like your response, that what we are dealing with in this particular case is a narrow exception to equal protection by denying same-sex couples the label of marriage, but leaving intact the substantive rights that this court established in the marriage cases last year?
But we are not leaving intact the foundation of equal protection. You cannot take away one right from a suspect.
It hasn't destroyed equal protection, Mr. Marshall.
But
as I pointed out, one could view it as a limited exception to equal protection. Your response is, well, it takes away equal protection. No, it doesn't.
No, my argument is not that it takes away equal protection. My argument is that in assessing whether a right exists within the Constitution. That is a power that rests with the court. And the argument is
we that may interpret, or our task is quite limited. As judges, we construe statutes, we construe constitutional provisions, but the people are those that have created the Constitution. And I think what you're overlooking is the very broad powers of the people to amend by initiative the Constitution.
No, not at all.
You may respond, but otherwise your time is up, Mr. Martin.
Our argument is that the position that we articulate with regards to the court's power is found within the Constitution, given to the court by the people. And so we're simply asking the court to exercise the power which the people have, in fact, given to the court to protect the fundamental rights of minority and individual citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Morocco, before you even start, I'd like to pick up on a discussion we were having with Mr. Marshall. Is there anything in the text of the California Constitution that supports the view that a qualitative revision must relate to governmental structure or organization? Does the Constitution even define revision versus amendment?
The Constitution doesn't define revision versus amendment, but Article 18, Sections 1 and 2 differ from Article 18, Section 3, and there's a reason for that. Article 18, Section 3 says the people, through initiative, can amend the Constitution, as does Article 4, Section 1, talk about the initiative process. But Article 18, there's got to be a reason why 18, 1 and 2 are different than 3. It doesn't say...
In what way? Would you share that with us?
Well, it doesn't say in Article 18, Section 3 that the people, through initiative, can revise the Constitution. It says they can amend the Constitution. An amendment's a word that's defined in the body of law, starting with Livermore in 1894, going through you and Ravens. And the amendment, as defined over and over again by this court, was it improves the body of law, the basic government doctrine, which is our Constitution. What I'd like to focus in on, to me, is a rather simple point.
Do you think the court in Frierson thought that the initiative improved the law that they set out?
The court in Frierson specifically pointed out, in that case, there's no question that the right to life is a liberty right that probably is equal to the highest liberty right, fundamental right. There's no question about that. But Frierson specifically pointed out, with reference to cruel and unusual punishment as applied to death penalty, which was the issue before the court, that issue is unique because what is cruel and unusual in 1979 when Frierson was decided may not be cruel and unusual in 1959 or 69. That issue is an issue that the people, through amendment or through the electorate, through a vote, can decide within parameters what's cruel and unusual.
Well, let me pick up on that.
And that was set forth in Frierson. Excuse me.
Certainly. In the marriage cases, I asked counsel, is equal protection an evolving concept? And the answer given me was yes. Equal protection is an evolving concept. So picking up on your point about cruel and unusual may vary, and I think the implication was that the people, by way of amendment, can speak to what cruel and unusual is. How does that differ from the people by amendment speaking to what is equal protection?
Yes, sir, and I'd like to address that. Article 1, Section 1, which is called in our Constitution the Declaration of Rights, it goes through Article 1 through Article 7, basically, is called the Declaration of Rights, which I think is viewed as akin to our state version of the Bill of Rights. It's our rights. Those are basic core rights that probably predate 1849, but they're there. And they've been amended, a change, and added to. Privacy was added to relatively recently, to Article 1, Section 1, so they evolved too, but usually it's an addition, not taken away. And in context of what this court stated, the majority stated in the marriage cases, marriage and the nomenclature of marriage, because that was argued. I was here before this court last year. And a number of judges, including Justice Moreno and other judges, asked the petitioner's side in that case, isn't it just a name? We have our registered domestic partnership. They have the same, basically all the same rights through the 5 years. They have them all, just a name. So what are we? What's the
and
big
Proposition
deal?
Proposition 8 did not change any of that.
Proposition, but this it didn't. It did change that because this court in
did
marriage,
not change any of the substantive equal protection rights granted by the domestic partnership.
It did not change those rights. Were there before we were in court last year? You had those.
Proposition rights. 8 did not change.
It did not change it, Your Honor. You're right. Probably marriage, kept those rights.
Marriage
but,
cases did constitutionalize those domestic partnership rights.
But the marriage, right? Yes, Your Honor, and it also, and clearly the marriage rights, just as George started off today by saying, went beyond the specific issues that were before the court. The court went beyond that by establishing suspect class and giving giving same-sex couples and gays and lesbians rights that were equal to the rights given to blacks and women under our prior cases. So it went way beyond the immediate issue. But what was before the court in the marriage cases was the nomenclature, was we conceded on our side, if you want, that 99% of the rights were already there by the time we were in this court last May.
Counsel,
but what wasn't
counsel,
there?
Two,
yes, Your Honor.
Two academics have put on the table a potential solution that I would like to have you comment on.
Sure.
One of the professors was for Prop 8 for religious reasons. The other was against Prop 8 for civil rights reasons. They suggest that marriage is has religious origins. They say that we should direct the state to employ non-marriage terminology. They suggest civil unions. My first question to you, is that a viable solution? And number two, is that really within the province of this court?
Okay. Reference to the first one, Your Honor. I think with reference to the Equal Protection Clause and the...
Just to make it clear, they're suggesting that the state should get out of the marriage business.
As far as we're concerned, if you're in the marriage business, do it equally. If you want to, if the state obviously stuck its finger in the marriage business, they should stick it there equally. And if they're not going to be equally, then get out of the marriage business. That's our position on that. So if you're going to apply, if you're going to allow one group of heterosexuals to get married and homosexuals have to be registered domestic partners, that doesn't fly with Article 1, Section 1. And doesn't fly with this court's decision that nomenclature matters. The way I read Justice George's majority opinion, nomenclature matters. And what Article 1, Section 1 now says after Proposition 8, what our Bill of Rights now says is all people, which is there, except heterosexuals, have the fundamental right to liberty. That's what it says.
I'm certainly willing to let you go back to your argument, but I want an answer to
my
two questions.
Yes, the second point, Your Honor, was...
Well, I haven't heard an answer to the first point yet.
My position is that if, in fact, our position is, rather, that if it's applied equally and the nomenclature is applied equally, no one gets married, then I think that complies with Article 1, Section 7, Equal Protection.
Counsel,
and the second question.
The court can repeat that quickly.
Is it the province of this court to do that, or should we leave it to the legislature and the governor?
Your Honor, I think the moment this court, there cannot be one second where this court allows a fundamental right set forth in Article 1, Section 1 of liberty and privacy, which is marriage, to stay out there in our society within our state where one group has greater rights than the other. So pending the court has the power and answer the court's question and the I think obligation to protect the minority groups, in this case gays and lesbians, and if they don't have the right to marry, then straight couples shouldn't have the right to marry as well. That's they do have the power. That's the answer to the question as far as I see it.
But for purposes of oral argument, when this court, as it has to, looks back on previous decisions that have dealt with the issue amendment versus revision, can you cite one case from our previous decisions that support your view that you have just articulated to the court that what the people did in Prop 8 is invalid? And I want you to consider your response in light of a number of decisions by this court where the court has limited the civil rights or fundamental rights of an unpopular group and upheld the validity of a particular initiative doing just that.
Yes, Your Honor. The only other case that I found that has that targets a minority group and deprives them of certain rights is Mulkey versus Wright, which is the Prop 14 case. But that wasn't decided on revision versus amendment. It was decided on Prop 14.
It was also decided on federal.
On equal, yes, at that time. But that case is the only factual case where a proposition was. In fact, that one won, if I remember, by 64.
I presume I 64. Just need clarification from you. In this particular case, there is no issue pertaining to the federal constitution, is there?
No, Your Honor.
We're dealing with the
state. No, Your Honor. But what we're talking about is there's what's been said by Mr. Marshall and Mr. Minter before. There's been no case, and that's why this case is unique. No case where a proposition was put on the ballot while this case was considering its ruling on the marriage cases last year, specifically targeting an anticipation of this court's ruling. I guess that the prop proponents were correct. What would happen on the marriage issue, and they put the same 308.5 of the Family Code, they embedded it in the Constitution. Now it's embedded there. It's there. For this court to look at and stare at every time you open the Constitution, you will see that the Equal Protection Clause doesn't apply to heterosexuals. It's there. Against the majority will.
Let me take you back to Proposition 14, where you were telling us
yes.
that there was a case where the rights of a group were taken away.
Yes.
Never was the question presented in that case, I think you were going to tell us, whether it was a revision
wasn't
or
brought
an amendment.
Up. Yes, Your Honor.
The question that had been put to you is, has there ever been a case before where the rights of a distinct minority have been taken away by amendment to the Constitution?
I couldn't find one,
Your Honor. The answer is no.
No, yes.
And this takes me back to the meaning of revision versus amendment. It has been said from the bench that all our cases have spoken about revision being an altering of the basic structure of government. Those are the cases that have been presented to the court. Has the court ever held that a revision not only is an altering of the basic structure of government, but must be? Have we ever held that, as opposed to having cases where that was the concern?
I don't believe there was a holding it must be, but it says a revision is either an altering of the constitutional scheme or the basic government plan. That's
and
the race.
Was that case held that there was a revision?
The case of Raven held that, but that wasn't a case directly directed to a suspect class.
But that was a governmental, that was a factual situation.
Yes.
So my point is, to pick up on what you earlier said, that this is a unique case.
Yes.
This court has never had the opportunity to look at not a structural revision, although the argument could be made and has been made that this is a structural revision, but to look at it from a different slant or a different lens, that this is a initiative that has altered fundamental rights, and that in itself could be a revision without tying it to the structure of government.
I agree, Your Honor, and that's basically the position we're advocating is, and it's a very narrow rule. The rule we would advocate is any initiative by amendment that attempts to alter a fundamental right to just one, to a suspect class. It can be very narrow.
Let me just
that
follow
in of itself
on that.
Is
Let me follow on Justice Whitaker's
yeah.
question. Is there any case in the 10 or so cases that deal with this issue that precludes what you're arguing?
No.
Is there any relevance, though, to the fact that we've had Proposition 209 on affirmative action? We've had the busing exception written into the Equal Protection Clause, which I referred to earlier. Now, admittedly, when those have been challenged, I don't believe they have been challenged, as Justice Werdegaard's question acknowledges, on the ground of
revision versus
amendment. But that's what's unique, perhaps, but it's not unique in the history of California that the initiative process has been used to restrict the rights of one minority group or another on behalf of the majority of the electorate. Isn't that correct?
No, Your Honor. I think that I would disagree with that because I'm not aware. I don't think there's ever been an initiative, a proposition on the ballot where the ballot material for the yes on eight people have on there that you should vote yes on eight because if you don't, they're going to teach gay marriage in schools. That's in the ballot.
Those are arguments made, but how do you address the fact that Prop 209 on affirmative action and the busing measures did pass, and they are enshrined into our Constitution in sections that deal with fundamental rights, whether we like that or not.
Because Prop 209 and the addition to the Equal Article 1, Section 7 is a remedy. I mean, the remedy of busing basically is on its face. It's not. It's race neutral.
Well, one could argue, I suppose, that the designation of marriage is somewhat akin to a remedy as opposed to the substantive right to form a family relationship and rear children, which is the core of the constitutionally recognized right of marriage that, we admit, I think appropriately, has not been altered by the passage of Proposition 8.
And, Your Honor, my response to that would be, then this Court would have no problem saying, with reference to the issue at hand, that if Proposition 8A, my hypothetical next proposition, 8A said that marriage is only between a white and a white and a black, going back to the pre-Perez Sharp era, putting aside the U.S. Constitution, Loving and all that, just concentrating on the state constitution, Prop 8A says that. Sharp is back. Pre-Sharp, Perez versus Sharp is back. It's only a nomenclature. We can have a black having a domestic partnership relationship with another black. They have the same rights.
Can I
marry a white. That's what we're dealing with.
Yes. Can I ask you a legal question?
Justice Corrigan, how are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
Thank you. I remember you asked me this question. I was on the stand, and you asked me the question last time in the marriage cases. What if there was a proposition passed, and it stood, and it won, and now we have a prop. I don't think we had an eight yet. I don't know. It was no number. A proposition right next to the Equal Protection Clause. What do you think would happen? I think you were the one who asked me that question.
Terrific question, don't you think?
I thought it was a good question.
Let me see if you like this one.
I enjoyed that question. I think my answer was, if I remember, I was kind of stymied. I said, well, we have two conflicting sections, and I think the Equal Protection Clause always would prevail. Why? I didn't know then, but I didn't have to do any
but
research.
But you're sure you were right.
I hope I'm right.
Let me ask you this question, because I want to make sure I understand the legal basis for your argument. You are urging the court, if I understand you, to articulate a rule with regard to amendment versus revision.
Yes.
That any time an initiative alters a fundamental right of a suspect class,
yes,
that action constitutes a revision. Is that the rule you're arguing?
That's the yes. Takes away a fundamental right from a suspect class. Yes.
And can we agree that we haven't ever said that before?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's what you're urging.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Now, does that mean only taking away or conferring? To go back to my hypothetical, if marriage cases had gone the other way and there were an initiative that extended the right of marriage to same-sex couples and put that in the Constitution, and that passed by way of amendment,
yes,
is that proper that it could pass
by
way of amendment? But if you want 2 years later to take it away,
To repeal it,
that is not an amendment. It's a one-way street. That's a revision.
Well, Your Honor, although initially one would say, how can one be an amendment and one needs a revision on the same thing taken? But I think given the line of cases that define amendments, starting with the Livermore case through you and through Raven and through Brosnahan and other cases, the amendment is defined as adding to or improving, taking away a fundamental right. And interveners, I don't believe, are going to argue that this court did not say in the marriage cases that marriage is a fundamental right. And nomenclature is important. Excuse me, Your Honor, that taking away that right, I would say, would be a revision of the Constitution. Yes, to be consistent, I agree. initially it doesn't sound like you can read at the 14th Amendment, and Mr. Starr correctly points out, was just the amendment itself was just added on in 1974, the actual 14th Amendment, the Article 1, Section 7, Equal Protection, our version of the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection, was just added on recently by amendment. What happens if we take it back? Can we take the 14th Amendment back, the Article 1, Section 7, State 14th Amendment back by amendment? Or do we have to revise the Constitution to take that back?
Mr. Morocco.
Yes, Justice Kennard.
Assuming that you still have a few minutes, so far we haven't heard anything by any counsel pertaining to what I think is an important issue in this case, the validity of the marriages that were performed.
Yes, Your Honor, retroactivity issue.
Before the passage of Proposition 8, and I would like to hear from you why, I presume you would be arguing strongly, that those marriages were valid. I'd like to hear from you.
Sure, Your Honor. The authority is, I think, very clear on that one, as opposed to the revision versus amendment we're talking about, where it's basically a new issue before the court. The clear authority is that that there's a presumption that all legislation is prospective, not retrospective. That's what the Fabian case and the Buell case in 85.
And taking a look at the language in the proposition, it says only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. 14 words. From your standpoint, does it matter that, well, I should rephrase it, and I should leave it to you how you're going to answer the, from your standpoint, the validity of those marriages.
I think the marriages, given the language and the opportunity more than once in the various rebuttal arguments in the pamphlets that went to the electorate for the proponents of Prop 8 to clearly point out or argue that it would affect retroactively the 18,000 marriages that occurred, the language itself in no way indicates that it would void the 18,000 marriages retroactively.
But then, of course, and it's really my fault, I didn't quite read the rest of that particular language. What I left out inadvertently after will be valid or recognized in California, regardless of when or where performed. As I recall, the opposing side relies on that particular language from, I think, the rebuttal to the argument in the proposition, right?
Yes. And I think that, again, there's ambiguity in that. And regardless of when that may have occurred, the interveners are arguing that would indicate that a retroactive intent. But it could be regardless of when the foreign person married in Massachusetts. Whenever that was done, it will not be recognized as a valid marriage in California. There is no clear, unambiguous language anywhere indicating that the intent and the effect is retroactivity.
And
I believe there's a reason for that. Had they put that in there, they may not have won by the narrow vote of 4% that happened here, because I think there would have been an uprising if that happened.
And just to make something clear, initially I did read from the language of the initiative, 14 words, but then what I really wanted to point out was the language that the opposing side relies on, which I mentioned to you, where it says, regardless of when or where performed. Is it your view that, given the fact that this particular language was a fleeting observation and buried in the middle of a rebuttal argument, that doesn't support the view taken by the opposing side that it was the intent of the voters when they voted for Prop 8 that the voters intended to invalidate the marriages that have taken place?
Yes, that's
you may respond, but your time is otherwise
up. Yes, sir. That's my point of view. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. We'll now hear from Ms. Stewart.
Thank you.
you may wait a moment, Ms. Stewart, while people reconfigure.
Don't push that button yet, please.
Okay.
May it please the Court. My name is Therese Stewart. I represent the city and county petitioners.
Ms. Stewart, I have just a quick question following Mr. Morocco's last argument on retroactivity. I mean, yes, it's true the rebuttal argument has language to the effect of wherever, whenever the marriage was performed. But looking at the plain language of Prop 8, it refers to only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. And I know people can argue over what does is mean.
Your Honor.
But, I mean, it seems it's in the present tense and that it would be looking at the current state of affairs, no pun intended, with the language.
Your Honor, similar language in the Myers case said that there exists no statutory bar for claims by smokers who have suffered injuries caused by tobacco products. And the Court held that that broad general language was not sufficient to make a measure retroactive. The language has to be unequivocal, uninterpretable any other way, and that simply isn't the case here. I don't think it's a close case remotely.
Well, aside from the language, I'm over here. Aside from the language, when the highest court of the state declares that same-sex couples have a constitutional right to marry, until such time as that rule of law is changed, under due process principles, how can one deny the validity of those marriages?
One cannot, Your Honor, and I think there are serious concerns under various constitutional provisions that my colleagues have briefed about what it would mean to go back and change the rights and benefits of transactions already entered into. But more importantly, it would go against this Court's jurisprudence in the area of interpreting statutes and constitutional provisions in a way not to be retroactive unless it is absolutely clear the intent was otherwise.
Ms. Stewart, back on the retroactivity issue, before you start to argue the issue pertaining to amendments less revision, as I asked Mr. Morocco earlier, here the opposing side, the interveners, rely upon one single sentence that appears in the fifth paragraph of the rebuttal to the argument against Proposition 8. And that sentence reads, telling the voters, your yes vote on Proposition 8 means that only marriage between a man and a woman will be valid or recognized in California, regardless of when or where performed. According to the opposing side, this supports its view that the marriages that have already been performed are invalid, and I would like your response.
That language, Your Honor, even that language is ambiguous and could be interpreted prospectively. That is, it's general enough that it is not a clear statement that the law was intended to invalidate marriages entered into prior to the enactment of the measure. And, Your Honor, the case law says that it has to be unequivocally clear. And, in fact, if the voters had intended here to grapple with the retroactivity issue, there are a number of questions they would have had to address.
Well, from your standpoint, and this is to follow up on my own question to Mr. Morocco earlier, from your standpoint, do you attach any significance to the fact that this particular sentence on which the opposing side relies in arguing invalidity of the marriages occurs, as I pointed out earlier, in the middle of some rebuttal argument?
Yes,
that very fact, would that show that the voters must have been aware of this particular argument buried in the rebuttal?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And it shows, if anything, that the voters didn't clearly contemplate the issue. They, in the Massachusetts measure that was proposed but didn't make it to the ballot, they grappled with the past marriages, and they said that they would be treated as civil unions. There's a lot of questions that are raised by retroactive application that if the voters were grappling with, they would have had to have been addressed much earlier and in a more careful and explicit way. But I'd like to turn back to the main issue. My colleagues
have discussed.
Before
you do, just one observation. As I recall, because of the timing on qualifying an initiative for the ballot. The drafters of Prop 8 drafted it and circulated it even before the marriage cases came down. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, the trial court had struck the marriage laws down. The Court of Appeal had reversed the trial court, but this court had granted review. So there was no doubt and no unawareness of the possibility. And, in fact, the interveners in their briefs admit that the possibility of this court ruling the way it did was why they put the measure on the ballot. So,
well, I guess my point is it wasn't drafted with the marriage cases under a microscope. In other words, it was anticipated. There had to be some anticipation.
Correct.
But no knowledge of exactly what the various holdings of the marriage cases.
Well, that's not true, Your Honor, because when the measure was submitted, and I think Mr. Kruger informed me that I got it wrong in our papers, it was in October when the initial language was put on the in the ballot pamphlet. So they could have addressed it in the very beginning of that pamphlet. They knew exactly what this court's ruling was. But I would really like to turn, if I might, my colleagues have discussed.
I'd really like you to turn there, too.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so could you, just to frame it, do you agree with the standard that has been articulated that we should articulate a rule that says an initiative that alters a fundamental right of a suspect classification constitutes a revision?
I do, Your Honor. My colleagues have focused on why Proposition 8 affects a significant change to our governmental framework, but I'd like to discuss why, and I agree with that, but I'd like to discuss why, even if that were not the case, Proposition 8 nonetheless is a revision. The case, as Michael Marocco mentioned, raises an issue of first impression, whether to enact a measure that alters our Constitution's core commitment to the protection of basic, our most fundamental civil rights and liberties, the people required of themselves that they would first undertake the studied consideration of the revision process.
Well, let me ask you, putting it in context, and of course we have to be concerned by any rule that we put down here having an effect, forget about things that already passed and cannot be looked at again, but future initiative measures and so forth. Let's, for the moment, take it outside the context of just this particular case and see how the rule that you put forth would apply. Let's just say there were an effort to undo Proposition 209 and say you can't take care of, take into account race in various matters affecting employment at schools. Or let's just say as well that there was some court ruling that said you can't have same-sex schools and people felt we need to have all girls or all boys schools. We're going to pass a constitutional amendment to that effect. These both deal with suspect classifications. They would affect fundamental rights. And is it your position that either one of those efforts would be invalid because they could be effectuated only by way of the revision process as opposed to an amendment process?
It is, Your Honor. If the electorate in California attempted to mandate that the government discriminate based on race, even for affirmative action kinds of reasons, that would be a revision under the rule that we propose, as would the implementation through a measure of single-sex only schools or single-sex schools. The recent revision cases that this court has addressed, to be sure, had occasion to consider whether a measure that alters the framework of our government constitutes a revision, but they do not establish that only a structural change constitutes a revision. And think about it. It can't be the rule. It would have made no sense for our framers to require great care and deliberation in protecting, in changing, in a way, the structure of our government, which we created to protect our fundamental rights and civil liberties, while requiring no similar care or deliberation for measures that directly attack those fundamental civil liberties.
How has the structure of government been changed by the voters' passage of Proposition 8?
The Equal Protection Clause is not simply a standalone measure. It's been in our Constitution from the very beginning. We've had equal protection provisions explicit, but it's also woven throughout every other provision of the Declaration of Rights. It divides the majority from the minority. It instills a principle about how we Californians govern ourselves. We made a social compact called the Constitution that with respect to the rights in the Declaration of Rights, we would treat each other equally. That is a structural protection. But I don't think the court need agree with me in order to conclude that this is a revision.
Ms. Stewart, if I may interrupt before you run out of time, and since this is a very difficult issue, at least I need all the help I can get from you and from the other attorneys. What is your response to the argument that with respect to the equal protection guarantee, the meaning or general understanding of that guarantee has been altered by this court's decisions over several decades? And in this particular sense, the scope of the equal protection guarantee, I don't think, is firmly fixed. But in my view, based upon a reading of past decisions, it fluctuates over time. And it would appear that in this respect, which I have just articulated to you, the equal protection guarantee is unlike the constitutional provisions establishing, say, the structure of government and the powers of the various branches, the meaning of which have changed very little over time.
Your Honor, I don't think the fact that we as a people have over time understood more broadly who's encompassed within that group, we the people, means that equal protection is not a core or fundamental principle. When the people put that provision in the Constitution, they created the three branches and entrusted to the courts the interpretation of all of our fundamental guarantees. The fact that the court interprets them in light of what we know at a given time doesn't make them unimportant, and particularly in the case of equal protection doesn't make it unimportant.
Counsel, I wonder if you could comment on the Raven case, which is the last case in which this court found that there was a revision. And the revision part dealt with ceding a number of functions of this court to the U.S. Supreme Court, but the part of Prop 115 that was upheld dealt with some very important substantive rights, with respect to the right to confront and cross-examine witnesses as a result of Prop 115, hearsay evidence is admissible in preliminary hearings, reciprocal discovery. The defense now has to turn over work and statements that they've obtained through their own investigation. Those are substantial personal rights. How would you comment on the ceding of those personal rights in the context of the equal protection that's at issue here?
Your Honor, none of those measures or aspects of the measure, Prop 115, selectively deprived any group of rights.
Well, but aren't criminal rights, the rights that we associate in criminal, aren't they rights that pertain to all of us?
They are rights that pertain to all of us, Your Honor. And what I'm saying is that the measure did not take those rights selectively from one group or another. Moreover, those rights involve procedural protections that largely go to the issue of whether there's a fair trial. This court's function in applying its law under due process and otherwise to protect the fair trial was not compromised by those measures, as the court found. But I'd like to talk about Raven in another way. Consider why this court held in Raven that a measure that severely undercut this court's power was a revision. It wasn't about the court's power for its own sake. This court in Solberg said the checks and balances, our separation of powers doctrine, is important, and we don't want to change it easily. Why? Because it's fundamental to our civil liberties. If a fundamental change to our structure of government is a revision, an equally fundamental alteration of underlying principles is a revision as well. Otherwise, we are protecting the moat while we allow the castle to burn down. And that is not what the framers intended. We know that. We know it from Livermore, which was decided closest in time to our Constitution, and which this court in McFadden held was in the mind of the voters when they adopted the initiative amendment power.
Ms. Stewart, what I'm picking up from all the briefs, and many, many, many have been filed, as you know, apart from the various parties, I think, and the Chief Justice may correct me on that. I think we received 63 or 61.
63 is correct.
And it appears to me that what some of the briefs have been trying to get across is that those of us who are in the majority in the marriage case this last year would, of course, have to agree that Proposition 8 is invalid. I don't see it that way. To me, the issue presented last year in marriage cases pertained to this court's authority to interpret a statutory provision in light of the state constitution. Today, we have a completely different issue, and I won't belabor this particular point because this has been argued by the or pointed out by the bench earlier, and we received responses from counsel on that issue. We have a pretty well-established body of law in California pertaining to what is or is not a revision. Those decisions do not give strong support to your position that the people couldn't do what they did when they invalidated or disagreed with one aspect of the marriage decision. The people did not invalidate the entire decision. Don't worry, I'm getting to a question. And past decisional law, at least in my view, doesn't support the argument that the people couldn't do what they did. And in addition to all that decisional law, I took a look at what occurred in, I think it was the state of Alaska, and the other state that comes to mind is the state of Oregon. And I'm sure that you are quite familiar with the decisions of the high courts in those particular states. Both dealt with a similar issue here. And I specifically recall that the High Court of Alaska took a look at California law pertaining to amendments less revision and came to the conclusion that what occurred in Alaska, similar issue as before us, was not a revision. So what do you have on your side that I may not be aware of that gives you strong support for your argument?
Your Honor,
you may respond, but having reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, your time is otherwise up.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Livermore case quite clearly says that the principles upon which our Constitution rests were intended to be permanent and abiding, and that changes to them would be revisions. We know the equality principle was important because the framers told us so. The delegates said things like, you embody certain fundamental principles of government in your Constitution for the protection of minorities and the well-being of the mass. Majorities can protect themselves. The Constitution is to be formed with a view toward the protection of the minority. The majority is the part to be governed. The restrictions of the law are interposed between them and the weaker party. Yet another delegate stated it even more simply. The object of the Constitution is to protect the minority. That is a fundamental principle, and under the Livermore case, departing from that principle in a major way, as this proposition does, is a revision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. Mr. Krueger.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Christopher Krueger, Senior Assistant Attorney General for Attorney General Brown.
Mr. Krueger, would it be more convenient for you if you were to raise the podium so you don't have to lean over so much?
I think it's raised. I think I'll just raise the microphone.
All right.
That's up. All right. I'm tall, sorry.
Clearly, Mr. Krueger, you're just way too tall to argue this case.
It's a disability, but I live with it. I would like to make 3 points today, if time permits. First,
before you do so, I have a threshold inquiry, Mr. Krueger.
Yes.
Naturally, I know that you are the representative of the Office of the Attorney General of California. What I would like to know is, given the fact that we have, in essence, two sides, one, the challengers to Proposition 8, and on the other side, the defenders of Proposition 8. I would like to know from you, on which side you are before you proceed with your argument.
The Attorney General is on the challenger side. Attorney General Brown believes that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution and should be invalidated by this court.
Do you agree with co-counsel that it's a revision?
Co-counsel? Oh.
Since you are on that side.
The people on your side.
Yes. No, the Attorney General, under existing precedent of this court, the Attorney General...
And why is it not a revision?
Because the test that this court has used in its existing precedent is whether it's a structural change to government. And those are the kind of things that have been held to be...
So there are a whole line of cases where we have said, no amendment, no amendment, no amendment. And we finally get to Raven and we say revision. What is the difference between Raven and the previous cases?
I think that the distinction in Raven is illustrated actually by in Raven itself, in that the court upheld or struck down a part of the Prop 115 that would have linked interpretations of our Constitution to the federal Constitution, and in essence made the United States Supreme Court the final arbiter of how we interpreted our Constitution. Whereas there are other parts of Prop 115 which were upheld as not being revisions because, although they affected certainly important rights, I think as maybe Justice Moreno mentioned, they were not changes in our structure of government.
So the flaw in that was identified in Raven was that that aspect of 115 would essentially have stripped the California Supreme Court of the ability to interpret its own constitution.
Yes.
And that would be a revision of our structure of government.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Are you here arguing for the same analysis of what constitutes a revision to say that an initiative that alters the right of a suspect class must constitute a revision? Is that the way you would articulate the rule?
No, we're not arguing we're not arguing that it's a revision. The point of all we're arguing for is initiative amendments cannot be used to take away fundamental rights to liberty protected by Article 1, Section 1 without a compelling interest.
Your position is that this is an amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, it's an ultra vires amendment. Now, what we're saying is under existing case law, it's not a revision. Now, if this court, you know, were to say that, you know, these kind of ultra vires amendments are also revisions. You know, revision amendment is, of course, a creation of this court in the is an interpretation of words in the Constitution which aren't in the Constitution defined.
Counsel, let me just have you just go back just a little bit. Raven was decided in 1990, but Legislature versus You is 1991. And the question I had was with respect to whether or not we're limited to governmental changes in governmental structure or plans in looking at the revision amendment analysis. The U case has language to the effect that a qualitative revision includes one that involves a change in the basic plan of California government. That, to me, doesn't seem to preclude another approach to this revision amendment argument.
And so, yes.
It includes government framework, but it seems to me it leaves open fundamental changes with respect to social rights.
Yes. Because this court's test is limited, this court could change it. And what we're saying is if this court wants to say,
we could revise it.
Well, revision amendment, of course, this goes to the text of the Constitution and not this court's holdings.
So you agree this is an issue of first impression with respect to individual rights and the amendment revision argument?
Yes. The Attorney General agrees it's an issue of First Amendment, and we very much agree with petitioner's view that this is an unprecedented kind of amendment in that it targets a suspect class, gay men and lesbians, to remove a fundamental right, the right to marry, which
but
is...
But just to get things right, going back to my question to you as to which side you represent, and you said the challengers, but then, of course, it became quite clear that you disagree with the view of the challengers on the issue of amendment versus revision. Unlike the challengers, The Attorney General of California takes the view that we here are not concerned with Prop 8 being a revision, right?
Not that you're not concerned, but that this, the Attorney General takes the position that under existing,
right,
existing case law, it's not a revision,
right,
but that it is certainly unconstitutional.
And getting to your ultimate, you're ultimately being on the side of the challengers, I gather that you have raised a pretty novel theory, and I wonder if you would be good enough to articulate that theory to the court. For invalidating Prop 8.
Since our 1849 Constitution and in our 1879 Constitution, Article 1, Section 1 has declared certain inalienable rights that are available to all people, among them the right to liberty. This court, of course, only last year, found that the right to liberty included a right of same-sex couples to marry. When you look
but when a right is described as inalienable in our Constitution, does that mean that the very use of the term inalienable means that it can never be changed or modified?
It's not that the word inalienable has some talismanic significance per se. It's that when you look back to 1911 and the legislature's...
Oh, go ahead, Mr. Kruger.
Excuse me. The legislature's powers in 1911, Article 1, Section 1 was a part of our Constitution before the Bill of Rights was held to apply to the states. It was a limit on our legislature's power. Our legislature did not have power in 1911 to revise, propose revisions. It only had power to propose amendments. It proposed the amendment allowing for the initiative process in 1911. It had no... But when it was doing so, it had no power to take the position that, unbridled by the right to liberty protected by Article 1, Section 1, that the rights of people could be put to a popular vote.
Mr. Kruger, I'd like to take you back to where you were a moment ago, having explored the answer to a question from the bench. You said last year this court, you were going to tell us, I believe, that last year, speaking of inalienable rights, this court did what? Articulated a new inalienable right? Is that where you were going to go?
This court interpreted the right to liberty and also privacy. The right to liberty, particularly in our Constitution, as prohibiting the state in a statutory scheme from preventing gay men and lesbians from marrying.
And this was
new. Proposition 8
had
passed.
Am I correct?
I'm sorry.
This was new.
It was a new holding.
It was new. And now the question is whether the people of the state of California, given the residual power they have under the Constitution of the state of California, can differ with what this court did last year and change it.
Yes, and it is our position that this is an ultra vires amendment that the people...
So your position is the people of the state of California can amend their Constitution. They just can only amend it in limited ways.
Yes.
And how do we define the extent of that limitation that we are now going to impose on the people?
Defining it by inalienable right to liberty in our Constitution.
All right. Well, let's go from there. We have that word, difficult as it may be to pronounce, set forth
for
some of us. Section 1, Article 1, that says all people are by nature free and independent and have inalienable rights. Among these, it doesn't say only, but among these are enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy. That's the end of Section 1. I'd like to know from you, how do you define that word? And what does it include? Is it different from an inviolate right under Section 16 of Article 1, which is what's used to describe the right to jury? What is that type of right, and what's the consequence of it being that type of right?
The reason we're putting so much emphasis on Article 1, Section 1, and it being inalienable, is because it was the earliest guarantee, because it was the guarantee that existed in the Constitution at the time the people acquired the right to have initiatives.
Is it just a question of timing? Because privacy, which I just read to you, was added, I believe, in 1972. We had no right of privacy, which, of course, is a significant aspect of this state's constitutional jurisprudence, because it extends privacy interests under the state constitution beyond what's in the federal constitution that lacks a specific privacy right. So it isn't just a question of when it was added, is it?
Well,
and there are all sorts of rights that are set forth even in Article 1, and I don't mean this too facetiously, really, but in Section 25, it states the people have the right to fish. There's also, under Article 10, Section 2, an access to navigable waterways. What is that special kind of right that cannot, under the Attorney General's novel theory, be diminished or removed except by way of revision as opposed to amendment to the Constitution?
Well, it's the right to liberty, Your Honor.
Would that include the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment under the state constitution?
Well, if you're asking whether our position conflicts with Frierson.
Well, I'm asking the preliminary question of, does the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment under the state constitution, is that one of the rights that would be inalienable?
Well, that would, I'm not sure, Your Honor, frankly. I believe it would be, since it's in the first article, and I believe it was in the 1879 Constitution.
Well, if we look at People versus Anderson, and I'll repeat the comment of California Supreme Court in People versus Anderson, the court said that the death penalty was, and again I'll quote, unnecessary to any legitimate goal of the state and is incompatible with the dignity of man and the judicial process. And in response to People versus Anderson, the people, by constitutional amendment, reinstituted the death penalty through the initiative process. Was that a valid amendment?
Yes, it was.
And how do you reconcile that statement with your current position?
Well, there's a different inquiry with regard to cruel or unusual punishment. And cruel or unusual punishment is judged upon contemporary standards. And it is perhaps uniquely among our constitutional guarantees a guarantee that looks at the feelings of society and the people. And it looks at community
standards.
So
if the people of California were to pass an initiative allowing the state to execute in the most cruel manner, the fact that it's been passed by the people is okay? Is that what you're saying?
If they pass a statute saying that?
Let's say a constitutional amendment. You mean the courts are obligated to take a poll to determine whether a particular manner of execution is, or a particular execution in general, is cruel and unusual?
No, I'm not saying the court is required to take a poll. What I was saying was that in Frierson and Anderson, right, Anderson first and then Frierson, the court looked at community standards, looked at things like survey data and how prevalent the death penalty was in other places to make that interpretation. If now you pose essentially two questions, by statute, no. If they pose a statute, of course, it's going to be reviewed under the cruel or unusual punishment.
Okay, we get the notion that statutes are trumped by the Constitution, but I think the question was, suppose it's made a part of the Constitution.
Well, essentially, it depends on whether it's a, you know, considered, I mean, the hypothetical statute, is it making it no longer part of liberty? I mean, is it saying execute, you know, every person, you know, for jaywalking, I think this court would find a way to review that constitutional amendment under
the
Constitution.
Well, there you go. We would find a way. And so how much of this is the court finding a way, and how much of it is an analysis of what the Constitution as enacted by the people requires?
How much of it is?
I'll withdraw the question, Mr. Kruger. Go ahead with your argument.
No, I'm
well,
sorry.
Let me ask you then, Justice Corrigan's question leads me to ask this. Article 18, Section 3 of the California Constitution states in its entirety, the electors may amend the Constitution by initiative. Do you consider that an inalienable right on behalf of the people?
I would think so at this point, yes, sir.
And how does that play into our review of Proposition 8?
Well, you have some duty to harmonize different parts of the Constitution. Yes, they have the power to the very power to have an amendment, an initiative amendment, does not mean that all initiative amendments are constitutional. Look at the single subject rule. Look at the revision amendment rule. And the fact that this is somewhat of a novel theory does not necessarily mean that it should be rejected. This court
particular theory, you rely on cases that date back to the middle of the 1800s. And
some of them.
My research has shown that the cases on which you so strongly rely on, they are based upon, I think, natural law, et cetera, et cetera. These particular cases have been soundly rejected in modern jurisprudence. But you are urging this court to base our holding here on the theory you're articulating to the court, that is the inalienable nature of the right at issue here, right?
Well, Your Honor, we really must disagree with your premise that these cases have been disregarded or the fact that these cases, some of them sound in ideas of natural law, which interveners criticize, does not mean that, say, issues about the right to make a living are necessarily not constitutional issues today. The fact that they're discussed in some language of the 19th century does not make them invalid cases.
All right. I would assume for purposes of oral argument that we leave to you to believe in the solid nature of the decisions from the mid-1800s that you so heavily rely on. Back, or to follow up on the questions that were raised by the bench earlier, you point out that here we're dealing with an inalienable right. But as other members of the court have pointed out to you, what about the inalienable right of the people to amend the Constitution as the people see fit? From the beginnings of our state constitutional history, the right of the people to alter or change the provision of the state constitution has been a basic right, a fundamental right, to use your term, an inalienable right. But us choose between these two rights, the right that you have mentioned to the court, the inalienable right to marry, and the right of the people to change the Constitution as they see fit. And what I'm picking up from the oral argument in this case is that this court should willy-nilly disregard the will of the people. I'm taking a look at, and I know the federal Constitution is not at issue here, but there the preamble says, we the people of the United States do ordain and establish this Constitution of the United States of America. Flip to the California Constitution. Preamble says, we the people of the state of California do establish this Constitution. Flip to constitutional provisions. All political power is inherent in the people, and they have the right, according to this provision, to alter or reform it. And there are other provisions talking about the great power of the people. The people establish the Constitution. As judges, our power is very limited, and I would like to hear from you why this court can willy-nilly disregard the will of the people to change the state constitution, as they have done in the past?
2 points, Your Honor. First, Your Honor is picking up on intervener's suggestion that we're sort of advocating for what they call judicial hegemony. And we, the people, is in the federal constitution. Well, there is no initiative amendment power in the federal constitution. Is there judicial hegemony there? No, we would not suggest that the federal government is not a democracy or the fact that life-tenure federal judges interpret it, and it's very hard to amend.
I agree with you that there is no power of initiative pertaining to the Fed. But to follow up on the question of the Chief Justice way earlier, where the Chief Justice pointed out, here in California, the people have a very, very broad power of initiative. The wisdom of the breadth of that power is not before this court. But as the Chief Justice pointed out earlier, when one takes a look at the initiative power in the various states, some have that, others do, but with restrictions. Some states do restrict the power of the people to change the Constitution. So it would appear, as the Chief Justice pointed out, and I think it was when Mr. Marshall was at the podium, when the Chief Justice pointed out, well, perhaps if there is a segment of the population of California that desires a change in the current initiative power, well, then there is the liberty, the freedom to do so, as has already taken place in other states where the power of the people to change provisions of the Constitution does not exist or is severely limited.
Well, Your Honor, I should explain. The people have always had a power to amend the Constitution. Of course, they didn't have a power to do so by an initiative until 1911. So it's not that they've always had the same power. And, in fact, for a while, there were different vote requirements and there were submission of certain initiatives to the legislature. So it's not like it's been the same power since 1879.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Krueger. Isn't the very essence of a democracy grounded in the right of the people to govern themselves?
Yes, Your Honor, but that could be through their representatives, too.
But of course, but the representative must only get their right if it is entrusted to them by the people. That's why democracies set up constitutions, to regulate the way they want to make decisions.
Yes, but that does not necessarily mean that they have unbridled power to take away fundamental rights from small segments of society.
Well, Mr. Krueger, let me ask you...
Without any judicial...
That last comment leads me to ask you, as I ask some of the other counsel, is this a one-way street or a two-way street? Does the same standard apply to any given right by way of extending that right and therefore being able to do it by way of amendment, but once that very same right would be restricted or rescinded, no, that can't be done by way of amendment. That constitutes a revision. How does that tie in to your inalienable right theory?
Well, we're not arguing that it's a revision. We're saying this is an amendment. But
Let's say permissible amendment and impermissible amendment. Does the same standard apply to the extension or expansive application of a right that applies to its restriction or rescinding?
Frankly, no, because the Constitution could have provisions that you could add in more constitutional protections that aren't. But that doesn't mean that you know.
But if you take them away, even though they were added by amendment, then it is impermissible to do that by way of amendment under the Attorney General's inalienable right approach to the amendment process. Is that the correct statement of your views? I just wanted to
understand. Yes. If this hypothetical amendment does what this amendment does, which is to take away a right of liberty without any compelling reason, there's been no effort by interveners to show any compelling reason why.
Mr. Krueger, what would your argument be if Proposition 8 passed before the marriage decision from this court?
That it would be the same argument. But it would, of course, be a longer analysis because first the court would have to be looking at whether a fundamental right had been in existence and whether it had it would sort of be it would have to do the first part of the analysis from the marriage case's decision and just keep going.
Or so how do we know what an inalienable right is?
What if Prop 22 was a constitutional amendment as opposed to an initiative statute? Would your analysis still be the same?
Yes, it would be the same, because that's really what this is. This is Prop 22 turned into a constitutional amendment.
Let me ask you this one other fundamental question. I'll defer to Justice Marino.
Yeah, how do we know what an inalienable right is? Do we just know it when we see it, like Justice Potter Stewart would say? I mean, is there a list, or is it entirely embedded within the right to liberty or the right to privacy?
Well, I think this Court very eloquently said in the marriage case's decision that constitutional concepts are not static, that they do evolve, that you know, while times have blinded us to certain truths, certain things become more apparent to us.
So we have a living constitution then in California? Maybe
yes.
One that's too easily changed, but nonetheless living?
Perhaps it does live. And I think the fact that, you know, our Constitution has been amended 500 times, while the federal Constitution has been amended 27 times, and all the Attorney General is saying is that a particular constitutional amendment like this one, which is so draconian, should be struck, that does not...
But wouldn't that call into question and forget about the past, because we can't rewrite history, wouldn't that call into question all sorts of future potential initiatives, as long as the subject matter could somehow be fashioned into the nomenclature of an inalienable right? That would mean that the people's initiative power was sidetracked, and there would have to be a two-thirds vote of the legislature or the calling of a constitutional convention. So doesn't this have ramifications not just on an ad hoc basis, but as we said in the McFadden case, you have to look at each one and see what it does, but it's going to have implications for future efforts if everything that could conceivably be characterized as an inalienable right is outside the people's initiative power.
Well, there aren't that many fundamental rights that have been recognized under this Constitution up until now. So
would you give us your list of what they might be? You mentioned the right to liberty and equal. Sorry. Your list of what might be the inalienable rights that you have in mind, starting with the one that is present here in your view. But
well, we would take the text of Article 1, Section 1, and say that since that was in existence at the time the initiative power was created, it can act as a interpreting those guarantees. Admittedly, they're open-textured kind of guarantees.
And yes, what are they? I keep referring to the ones that were in place when the initiative power came into being. What's the context of the article? What does it say?
Well, what it says is the right to, you know, all people, I mean, Chief Justice George read it, all people have a right to liberty and equality, and you know, ultimately says privacy has property in there.
Possessing and protecting property, okay. And pursuing and obtaining safety, happiness, and privacy.
What about the right to safe schools? That is called an inalienable right under Section 28, Subdivision C.
Yes.
I assume since it's called that, it is it, even if we don't know what that term necessarily means. But there are other things, maybe the rights I referred to earlier as the right to fish and the right to access to navigable waters, that presumably do not enjoy the same status in that hierarchy of rights so as to call them inalienable. Is that your position?
Right. Well, the inalienable right to safe schools was added, I believe, by one of the, is it Prop 8 or Prop 115, and those were, and so there's not... Those are not fundamental rights in the same way that liberty guarantee in Article 1 is.
But well, Mr. Kruger, so is there a difference between inalienable and fundamental?
Inalienable was used by our drafters of our Constitution because fundamental rights were no longer were not yet recognized in the lingo of constitutional law.
Okay, well, is the essence of your argument that the people have a right to amend their Constitution? Unless they do it in a way that the Supreme Court really doesn't like.
No, absolutely not.
Well, how's your argument different?
we would be adding, we would be asking this court to, we are asking this court to strike down Prop 8 because it violates Article 1, Section 1. But that's not, it's not whether this court likes it or not, because I'm sure, you know, there are existing ways in which this court strikes down constitutional amendments.
Yes, one is to call them a revision, but apparently this isn't a revision in your judgment. So how do we determine which amendments are okay, since you're saying this is an amendment, and which the people have somehow given up their right to engage in?
And you may respond to that, but your time is otherwise up, Mr. Kruger.
I think we always a good question before I answer. You would look at, you know, this court has already said that liberty in Article 1, Section 1 protects the right to marry for gay men and lesbians. And therefore, in this particular case, and I wish I had all morning to talk about this, Justice Corrigan, in this particular case, there's no compelling reason, there's no compelling justification for this initiative amendment, and Proposition 8 should be struck down for that reason. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger. We are now from Mr. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In light of the colloquy just now with General Kruger, I would draw the Court's attention, in light of the extraordinary body of law that this Court has developed over literally decades, to the words of one of the great justices to sit on this iconic Court, Justice Matthew Tobriner. It has to do with sovereignty of the people. We have heard an enormous amount by very able counsel about individual rights and suspect classifications. Those are very important topics. What we did not hear a lot from the other side is this inalienable right of the people of California, whether wisely or no, to change the Constitution.
So from your standpoint, as has been articulated by the bench earlier, the Attorney General points to one inalienable right, the right to marry, and it was pointed out to the bench, the people, too, have an inalienable right. And what the Attorney General ran out of time, but I yet have to get a definition of what is inalienable. I would like to ask that question of you. What does the word inalienable mean as used in the California Constitution?
It cannot be taken away except with the appropriate process. And one of the inalienable rights that this Court has articulated decade after decade, this body of jurisprudence is so stable. It's so beautifully developed. It's one of the reasons, as the Court noted, that courts around the country look to this Court, and rightly so, with respect to this among other bodies of jurisprudence. The body of jurisprudence here includes the proposition that the right of the people is inalienable to control their constitution through the amendment process, and that's been the case, and this is where the Deputy Attorney General agrees, since 1911.
That's true. I don't even think it's in dispute, and it's a wonderful attribute of our government. I'd like you to address what I know you're going to. Why is what transpired here an amendment, which the people have the right to do, or a revision, which the people also have the right to do, but by a different procedure? Why is this not a revision, not only because the past language that we've had, which talks about the structure and the architecture of government, but because of the, one might argue, far-reaching implications of taking a suspect class and removing from them certain protections? So why is this not a revision?
To embrace the rule, if that were the rule, would be an unprecedented revolution in this Court's jurisprudence.
The rule that altering fundamental rights of a protected class. The case has never come up before.
It has been very, I agree, the precise issue because of the suspect classification dimension has not been before this Court. It's had some very close analogs. And when you look, and you have favored counsel with a number of quotations from this Court's jurisprudence, when you look at that jurisprudence, and I would begin with Amador Valley's looking back on Livermore v. Wade, and then as you trace the case law through, Legislature v. Liu, the Raven case, a wide variety of cases. It comes down to this. This is the law that the people of the state understand. It's been articulated by justice after justice with a remarkable degree of unanimity. This court on this issue, even though it has split on other issues in the arena of was this a proper amendment, the single subject rule and the like, this court has been unanimous in saying, unless, Your Honor, it goes to the structure of the government, not to rights. Very important rights have, in fact, been either taken away or dicta, such as in the Amador Valley case, noting the possibility that there could, in fact, be the structural change of what? A shift of the judicial power to the legislative branch.
Well, let me put your theory to this test. Let's take something that would arguably certainly be a non-governmental structure in nature. Let's just say there was a very specific amendment that deleted the right of free speech from Article 1 of the Constitution, period. Nothing to do with governmental structure. Is that something that, because it doesn't deal with governmental structure, you feel could be accomplished by way of amendment, or is this such that a revision is required?
Well, first of all, I would, of course, be dead on arrival under the federal Constitution.
Right. As we would all agree. A lot of things would, but we're just, of course, confined here to the state Constitution.
But the hypothetical doesn't...
Or it wouldn't be dead. What would happen is, arguably, it would be dead under the state jurisprudence, but there would be protections extended under federal constitutional law that would take care of it. But there's nothing in the federal constitution, I would posit, that requires a state to have in its own constitution a First Amendment equivalent.
Quite true, but because, and again, I don't mean to quibble with a hypothetical and I will treat it, but because of incorporation, we all enjoy, as citizens of this state, but also we're citizens of the United States, so we do enjoy protected rights to free speech. Even there, while it is unthinkable, and that's one of the wonderful things about the amendment process and the initiative process, most don't make it through. That would not get the... But let me deal with the hypothetical. Under our theory...
But, counsel, don't we start with the proposition that the people of California cannot change the California Constitution in a way that violates the U.S. Constitution?
Absolutely. That's my fail-safe point. But it's not in terms of the specific issue of is it an amendment, is it a revision, and is there a limit on the power of amendment? No. Our theory is, and our submission is, reading this court's jurisprudence, accepting the propositions that have been advanced, including by Justice Mosk in his remarkable concurring opinion in the death penalty case, saying this is macabre, what the people have done is macabre, it is callous, it is unenlightened, but they have the power to do it. And so my answer is the people do have the raw power to define the rights. That's the nature of the consent of the government.
So, it's Mr. unthinkable, Stark, given your response, does your argument here, and I think the answer is going to be no, depend on the theory that's been advanced that Prop 8 only affected the nomenclature of the relationship between gays as opposed to taking away domestic partnership rights or all the other governmental respect given to the personal relationships. So your argument does not depend on the fact that only the nomenclature is impacted.
It does not depend on that, but it's part of the assurance that this court has as to the wisdom of the people, because propositions that would take away the substantive rights, the bundle of rights that gay and lesbians enjoy, same-sex couples enjoy, under the jurisprudence of this court, under the legislature, legislation passed by the legislature year after year, Proposition 8 does not go
but
to that bundle
had,
of rights.
But if it had, your argument would be,
would
the,
be
same.
The same.
What about Romer versus Evans, where the people of the state of Colorado, by initiative, passed an initiative saying that no anti-discrimination law in the state of Colorado can, I may not have this exactly right, but can protect gays. In other words, gays are excluded from any anti-discrimination laws of the state. Would the people of the state of California be able to enact this by way of amendment?
Several responses, Your Honor. First, that, of course, represented Romer v. Evans, a federal constitutional challenge. And our colleagues on the other side have seen fit not to advance any such challenge. Secondly, Romer v. Evans had to do with participation in the polity. Can you, in fact, participate and enact legislation through an initiative process or their local ordinances? Here there is no question. The political process remains open.
But could the people, if there were an initiative on the ballot and it passed by a majority vote, under your view of amendment versus revision, of forgetting about the problems of the federal Constitution, would that be acceptable?
Under our theory, the people are sovereign, and they can do very unwise things and things that tug at the equality principle.
I want to make sure that I understood your answer to Justice Werdegaard's question or the earlier part of it. You are saying that if Proposition 8 had explicitly stated that apart from nomenclature, we're not dealing solely with that, the right to form a family relationship and to associate and bring up children and so forth, virtually all the domestic partnership rights, if you will, were abolished. And in fact, another initiative that did not acquire enough signatures to accompany Proposition 8 on the ballot just about would have said that. But let's say Proposition 8 had gone that far. You're saying that that would be permissible as an amendment. It would not constitute a revision. I just want to make sure that that's how you'd answer
it. It still would not constitute a revision because we believe under this Court's jurisprudence there must be, and this is the language of Amador Valley, which has been repeated over and over, there must be a far-reaching change in the basic structure of government. All these hypothetical questions have to do with rights, very important rights, rights that will be protected through the federal Constitution, even if the people unwisely act through the initiative process.
So but right to marriage, right to free speech, whatever, that can be removed by the simple amendment process.
As long as it is, in fact, clear to the people what they're voting on. This is the message that Justice Mosk, when he was in this on this bench, lift it up again and again. Make sure that it is clear, that it's unambiguous. Make sure that it deals with only a single subject. But at bottom, all of the parade of hypotheticals simply means is we govern ourselves, and we may govern ourselves very unwisely. But happily, because we're in a federal republic, there are fail-safe mechanisms under the federal Constitution.
Just one additional hypothetical.
I'm sorry?
Just one additional hypothetical. So initiative amendment to preclude same-gender couples, whether they're under the DPA or existing marriages, to preclude them from adopting children. Under your view, that would pass muster?
It would be, a power of the people. That's our theory, Justice. It would pass constitutional muster on this particular. It would fall. That is the critical point. It will not survive that kind of violation of the equality principle.
Is it your view that the other aspects of the marriage cases that deal with suspect classification, strict scrutiny, those principles remain intact under Prop 8?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Good. With all that answer, let me ask you a different question. Is it an accurate statement of your position, because you have said several times that people retain the right to their own legal structure, even when they are unwise?
Exactly right.
Isn't it, wise is, of course, a normative word. Isn't it another way to say that, that the people have a right to decide what is wise when it comes to their own legal structure?
That is exact. Yes, the answer
is
yes.
And when they act in the way you presuppose, fully informed and freely and properly done by the structures that are in place, if they decide that a certain legal structure is wise, it is not for another branch of government to say otherwise.
That's our theory. Because of the ideal lifted up by justice after justice of the consent of the governed and popular sovereignty, because one of the inalienable rights articulated in the Constitution and the jurisprudence is control over the Constitution. Now, if you get into what are the inalienable rights that might not be protected, one of the inalienable rights in Article I, Section 1 is the right to property. I really don't think that the Attorney General would be here advancing a compelling state interest kind of analysis if there were an issue that simply raised questions of property rights. But why isn't that? Property rights are very fundamental and foundational. They are there, articulated in the body of the Constitution. It is why, ultimately, the trust is in the people, with the exception, this was the wisdom of Amador Valley. It was the wisdom of Frierson. It was also the wisdom of this court in Lance W. Because in Lance W., this court said, admittedly in dicta, that the entire Fourth Amendment right, what we call the Fourth Amendment right, but the Article I right, to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures could be abrogated entirely.
Well, that's not the case. Lance W., there, a search that was illegal is still illegal. All Lance W. did was to carve out an exception as to remedy.
That's
right. Nothing to do with California's analog of the Fourth Amendment.
Well, Your Honor, I am referring to the sentence in Lance W. It is dicta, as I said at the outset, that if it chose to.
But the people could, by amendment of the Constitution, repeal Section 13 of Article 1. It's yes. Entire. It's clearly dicta.
I agree. The point that I'm trying to make is not that that is the rule that you must follow. That is indicative of this vast body of jurisprudence that every justice to sit on this court has agreed since 1911 that the power of the people to change the Constitution, including rights, a right as foundational as the right to life in the death penalty, not a suspect classification, I agree. But even there, this court in Osborne noted that what was at issue in the death penalty arena were minority rights, because we know the arguments.
Mr. Starr, is it problematic that Frierson was a plurality opinion?
Your Honor, I read, first of all, no, because it is nonetheless the fact that all justices agreed that the people had the right through the initiative process to enact by majority vote an amendment to the Constitution to restore the death penalty. My own reading is Justice Mosk and his colleagues fully agreed with that proposition. Fully agreed with that proposition.
Did they agree on the amendment revision, though, analysis part of the challenge to the death penalty initiative?
Yes. Of the revision amendment, I believe that notwithstanding what Justice Moss writes later extrajudicially in a law review article, that if one goes back and parses those opinions, I believe the reasonable reader will come to the view that the court was quite clear in saying the people had the right to restore the death penalty via an amendment.
And the Jackson case really put its imprimatur, didn't it, on Frierson, because that was not a plurality, and it later affirmed the rule in Frierson.
Exactly. And so when we look at the full body of jurisprudence, I want to turn to Raven, because Raven, I think, again, illustrates why it is that this court's very stable body of jurisprudence, to which other courts have looked, to which every justice to sit on this court has subscribed when he or she has had occasion to consider this, Raven makes the point. All of these rights, and Justice Moreno's colloquy with counsel pointed this out, a wide and vast array of very important rights, foundational to a free people. No suspect classification. You can distinguish it that way. I understand that. But still, very profound rights can be taken away, notwithstanding the single subject rule. There was disagreement. But with respect to revision, all of the justices came together for the reasons that have already been articulated in the colloquy. Why is that? Because there is a stripping away of this court's power.
What is your response to opposing counsel's argument that the purpose of the Equal Protection Clause is to protect minorities from discrimination at the hands of the majority? So how can the majority reinstate discrimination that this court said the Constitution prohibits?
Your Honor, all constitutional rights, not simply equal protection are designed to protect all of us. Each of us is a minority of one. And there's no question that the equal protection value is a very important value. But the Chief Justice's colloquy has noted that in various and sundry ways, the people have looked at equal protection and they have carved out exceptions. And so I want to come to what does Proposition 8 do? Proposition 8 does not, in fact, erode any of the considerable bundle of rights that this state has very generously provided. It has done what? It has said, and here is the context, we want to restore the traditional definition that has been in place since this state was founded, and almost every other court in the country has agreed with the rationality of that. You may think it's bad policy. You may think it's unenlightened. You might think it's callous and macabre. That's what Justice Moss thought about the reinstitution of the death penalty.
Mr. Starr, but under your argument about revision versus amendment, it doesn't really matter that that is all that the initiative has done.
That's right, but you have
I don't mean to interrupt you.
I interrupted you, and I apologize.
As I'm concerned about revision versus amendment, that almost becomes irrelevant, that how narrowly, allegedly, the electorate acted to impact the rights of gays and lesbians.
You're right, Your Honor. Sufficient to this day is focusing on the issue before us. My theory that we have articulated in our briefs is the theory embraced by this court. We're asking you simply to stay the jurisprudential course, not to chart a new course to say, well, heretofore we have only determined that there was a revision when there was, in fact, a far-reaching, or this court has also used this twice, sweeping change in the structure of government. Structure. Now, why is that? That takes us back to Livermore v. Wade. When the legislature was trying to move the Capitol from Sacramento to San Jose, and we have these essays that our brothers and sisters on the other side quote very generously from, and rightly so. A constitution is indeed a permanent and enduring document. And there are underlying principles. And what are those underlying principles? We now know, thanks to Amador, thanks to case after case after case, that justice after justice has signed his or her name to, it has to do with the structure of government and separation.
But heretofore, Mr. Starr, and I absolutely agree with you, the cases have that language. But heretofore, that's only been the issue that's been presented to the court.
Well,
this is the first time that the argument has been made to the court, in my knowledge, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, where the court has been asked to look at revision in a different light with a different problem. So you're absolutely right that every justice, I'll take your word for it, has agreed to that formulation of what is a revision. But that has been the problem that's been presented to them, even in Frierson, where the question was, did this alter the structure of government? So this is new to us. So these other opinions that other states look at are persuasive on the issue that was involved. But we, and as other counsel has said, it's definitions supplied by this court as to what is a revision. And the fact that it's always been said to be a structural restructuring of government doesn't mean that we've said it must be a restructuring of government. So this is a new day.
I think you have said it. You may not have used the must word, but, Your Honor, opinions have integrity.
For the subject that they were addressing.
And they included rights.
Well, doesn't it make sense, Mr. Starr, for when the legislature's interests may be at stake, or when the governor's, the executive branch's interests may be at stake, that they be at the table in terms of passing on whether or not a measure should proceed by way of a revision?
Very much so, and I would simply add to that, governors change and legislatures change, but the enduring structure is there to protect liberty. That's the key. That's what this court has focused on. Let us protect the integrity of the structure or architecture of government. And Justice Warrior, we may simply agree to disagree because this court's jurisprudence has talked time and time again about rights. Rights are important, but they don't go to structure. Has this court ever been presented with this precise question? No, but you have so much teaching before you. You have literally this cloud of judicial witnesses around you that have weaved this body of law that everybody in the world thinks is quite clear. If you tinker with the structure, taking away the power of this court, that was the Amador Valley hypothetical, and it came to life in Raven. You've gone too far, people. You cannot do that because why? You have eroded the independence of one of the coordinate branches of government. But, Your Honor, rights are ultimately defined by the people.
Mr. Stark, can I ask you another question about the power of this court? About 2 hours ago, I asked a question of Mr. Morocco, and I don't expect you to remember it, but you might, because it involved a proposition that was set forward by two of your employees. Two professors from your law school suggested one in favor of Prop 8 because of civil rights reasons, one opposed to Prop 8 because of religious reasons. Do you have that question in mind, or would you like me to repeat it?
Would you mind repeating it just to be sure? I did perk up when I heard professors. Usually you don't hear professors referred to in colloquy, so I welcomed it.
The professors suggest that marriage has a religious origin. And they suggest the solution to the problem is that we direct the state to employ non-marriage language to all couples, and that it be called a civil union, and that essentially the state get out of the marriage business. Number one, does that solve the problem? And number two, is that the province of this court?
Yes and no. It does solve the problem because, may I elaborate it?
You don't have to.
I would like to if I may.
You may.
Yes, it does solve the problem because, of course, the issue and the gravamen of the complaint here is the inequality. Individuals who are committed to one another, but they're not able to enjoy the same status. And marriage cases spoke to that. And the court articulated that in a very, very detailed opinion. But at bottom, this court in marriage cases was talking about the California Constitution demands equality. The California Constitution, but now, of course, there's Article 1, Section 7.5, which has been called Prop 8, but it's in the Constitution, and it's 7.5. And so that has been answered. The definition of marriage, and that's what I was trying to articulate before, that Proposition 8 is indeed very limited. It doesn't, in fact, override the analysis of this court. What it does say is here is a traditional term that societies across time and space, Her Majesty's government, would agree that marriage, in fact, should be retained. The government of France believes that it should be retained for opposite-sex couples. The vast majority of states, this court disagreed, and that's fine. But the point is, it disagreed not in the framing of social policy, but because of the equality principle. As long as the equality principle is, in fact, honored, then the answer is yes. If I may answer this, elaborate on the second part, emphatically no. It's the province of the Judicial Department to say what the law is. This court quotes, rightly so, from Chief Justice Marshall, and that is your province, and that's what you were doing in marriage cases. But to actually to make a recommendation to the legislature, say here are alternatives to solve this particular issue, because of the anguish and the angst and the goodwill on the part of individuals who want this value of equality in this particular, here is an alternative, but it obviously would exceed emphatically the judicial function to say this is our remedy.
But you would not disagree that tomorrow, if it chose, the majority of the legislature, easy for me to say, a majority of the legislature could pass a law that says nobody gets to be married in California anymore, but everybody who can meet the qualifications gets to be a domestic partner or a part of a civil union or some other word.
I agree, and may I elaborate? The reason I agree is because marriage, while a very foundational right, it is so profoundly important. It is also, and it's been described by this court, is a three-way project. There's someone in the room, and it's called the state. The state has chosen to go in the room. And so this court, both in marriage cases and then in particular in the Lockyer case, when you were looking back on the activity here in the city and county of San Francisco and what should be done under those circumstances, this court said very emphatically that marriage is a closely regulated relationship by the state, and the state enjoys, and we know this from the Walton case, don't we, that Mrs. Walton felt this is profoundly unfair. The rules of the game have changed with respect to marriage. This is wrong. This is unfair. This is no-fault divorce. That might seem inconsequential to us. It was very consequential to Mrs. Walton. She said, this is a violation of due process. You cannot allow this character to leave the relationship for essentially no reason whatsoever. And this court said, the Court of Appeal, but this is the law. The legislature controls marriage. I beg your pardon.
Mr. Starr, a question pertaining to the theory raised before us by the Attorney General of California. As we all know, the Attorney General has urged this court to invalidate Proposition 8 based upon the theory of inalienable rights. Why shouldn't we adopt the theory proposed by the Attorney General?
Because this is a court of law that's guided by its precedent. It can change that precedent. I hope it won't change its precedent. It's so rooted in foundational principles. And I think the colloquy that you had with respect to those quaint 19th century cases, the inalienable
right... Of course, you may recall that the Attorney General would not associate the word quaint with the excerpts that he so heavily relied on.
Well, I respectfully disagree with my brother, Christopher, in the connection with that, because it's pretty quaint for, with all due respect to the predecessors of this great court, to hold that the ability to scalp theater tickets is an inalienable right. That's just laughable now.
Well,
laughing, but it is laughable. The theory is too open-ended. It is so malleable. That is, as was suggested by the bench, it's what this court wants, like Lola and damn Yankees. What this court wants, it gets. That can't be the governing principle of a court that honors its jurisprudence and that has found unanimity in this jurisprudence with respect to the power of the people on amendment and revision.
If we were to agree with the theory raised by the Attorney General, would that require this court to assume the existence of natural laws that exist independent of the state constitution?
I think so. I think, and I don't want to be unfair to the Attorney General and his very able staff, but when the brief is quoting John Stuart Mill on liberty and cases from the 19th century that we would now say, well, those were Lochner-era cases that no one would go along with these days in terms of the power of the legislature, there was a sense of the power and force of individual rights to do what? Freedom of contract. That may not seem quite so special to us these days in terms of freedom from legislative initiative, but change the personnel of the court, change the values of the people on the court, and I now think what? The right to life is, in fact, foundational. The death penalty becomes unconstitutional.
And I promise I have one last question, and sorry for interrupting, but I'm afraid you may be running out of time. But you just uttered a term that perked my interest. You referred to freedom of contract. Well, that leads me to this question. If we were to construe Proposition 8 as invalidating marriages that were performed before the enactment of Proposition 8, would that violate the contract clause or the due process clause of the federal constitution by impairing vested rights?
Your Honor, if I may, I'm going to be very direct. I do not believe that Proposition 8, and we have submitted this, quote, invalidates. What it does do is deny recognition. The words of Proposition 8 could not be clearer. Only those 14 words, only, is valid or recognized. It's a validity and recognition. And thus, the full panoply of rights that attended to the interim marriages, the 18,000 marriages, and I know there's an enormous amount of humanity and emotion involved in it, those relationships enjoy the putative spouse doctrine and other ameliorative doctrines. And in fact, those relationships, if they go to a state or to a jurisdiction more generally where same-sex marriage is recognized, obviously no one is tearing up the marriage certificate.
So you're saying the rights would continue, it's just the recognition.
The validity and recognition. No, it also goes to validity. It does go to validity because they would then have to embrace equitable doctrines such as a putative spouse, but it's no longer valid. But in short, there is nothing in Proposition 8 or in the voter materials that suggested that these marriages were void ab initio.
Even though the rebuttal argument does say Proposition 8 will not take away any other rights or benefits, you think that would still be consistent with your approach that past marriages are invalid and not recognized?
Because of the full panoply of rights, and this was in the materials as well, the voter materials, and again, there was a proposition that didn't make it onto the ballot that would have stripped away domestic partnership rights. This is a moderate provision that is designed
Starr, really fair to the people that depended on what this court said was the law, upended their lives, changed their property responsibilities with their spouses? Is it really fair to throw that out?
Your Honor, first of all, I would quarrel with, quote, throwing it out. Again, our position is more, if I may say so, specific with respect to that. But I would say this, Your Honor, and I will say this with all understanding that relationships were entered into and so forth. There was a swirl of uncertainty in this.
Well, wait a minute. There may have been a swirl of uncertainty in public opinion, but this court had said, as a matter of constitutional interpretation, this is the law in California. If Californians can't rely on the statements of this court about what the Constitution says, who should they ask?
Well, Your Honor, they, of course, are aware constructively that the law controls the marriage relationship, the definition of marriage. That is the law of the state, and it's the law of every other state. And so just as different set of facts, but the same kind of principle and the same kind of anguish was involved with Mrs. Walton when she was told, I'm sorry, the no-fault divorce applies to you as well.
Well,
so
change
the rules.
Let me ask you this. Let's just say the legislature, or rather an initiative, decided that no longer should the age of consent to marriage be 18, raised to 21. Kids are just too immature. They're messing up. They don't know what they're getting into. It's got to be 21. Or take another example, that first cousins, there's some new scientific evidence that indicates first cousins shouldn't be able to marry. It's got to be a further distant relationship. That passed, properly placed on the ballot. Would that invalidate all the marriages and cause them not to be legally recognized? Those persons who were 18, 19, and 20, or first cousins, are those marriages thrown out under your theory?
With this wording, the wording of valid or recognized, we will no longer treat that what had been an underage marriage as valid.
Right. So 19 and 20 years olds who got together in a marriage, bought a home, had children, suddenly they are not validly married. Those marriages are not recognized under your theory, correct?
But they're no longer valid under our theory. But if I may, the law, both through the wisdom of the common law and the wisdom of legislatures, has in fact embrace ameliorative doctrines, including the putative spouse doctrine, for those who are entered into in good faith. But if I can go back to the temporal dimension of this, and this is the flinty reality is, at the time that Proposition 8 qualified on the ballot, the Secretary of State, of course, the world knew that this remained an issue. At the time that it qualified on the ballot, same-sex marriage was not legal. There is a two. If you look at the timeline, once it qualified, and of course the signature gathering process, it is true. The signature gathering process, of course, goes back to 07. Why? Because of the swirl of uncertainty, what might in fact happen
But here is the flinty reality. At the time this court's decision became final, our pronouncement about what the Constitution dictated in terms of the right to marry became a part of the law of this state. We agree with your position, the law was changed by virtue of the electorate's action. But aren't those couples who relied on the constitutional pronouncement of this court about the Constitution of this state entitled, if nothing else as a matter of equity, to rely on the law as it existed at the time they took the action that they did?
And to, in fact, say we were validly married. It's true. They were validly married under the law of the state as articulated by this court after it denied the stay. And so, as of that day in June when the marriages began, it was valid and continued to be valid. However,
aren't you blinking reality by saying that they're married for the 6 months, but after that, they're not?
No longer valid or recognized. That's what, in fact, do the people have the power to pass, and does the legislature have the power to pass? If I may play with this hypothetical very briefly, plural marriage permitted, we no longer want plural marriage. What do those who have, and this court has actually had occasion to deal with that kind of issue, but a plural marriage lawfully entered into in the jurisdiction, but this court wouldn't recognize it. Why? Because it's unlawful under the law of the state. Is that fair? Well, then this court said, you don't simply say we're not going to pay attention to the relationships. This is humanity. This has to be dealt with. The law is flexible. It's supple. And that, of course, gave rise to another example of the putative spouse doctrine.
But, Mr. Starr, it would appear that in this particular case, there is no clear indication that at the time the voters of California voted for the passage of Proposition 8, that the voters understood that their vote in favor of Proposition 8 would mean that those people, those couples who got married before enactment of Proposition 8 would, after passage of Proposition 8, be unmarried.
I respectfully disagree for these reasons, and I hope I can persuade you. Reason number one, context is critical here as elsewhere. And the context is 170 years of California history. Second,
so I think context would mean that we take a look at the language at issue here, and the language says, it tells the voters, your yes vote on Proposition 8 means that only marriage between a man and a woman will be valid or recognized in California, regardless of when or where performed. And I realize that you rely on the when or where performed, the present tense in which the language is phrased. My response to that would be, and I would like your counter response to what I'm asking, it would appear that given the fact that this particular language was buried in a rebuttal argument, one surely cannot expect the voters of California to be quite familiar with provisions buried somewhere in a rebuttal argument.
Your Honor, if I may respectfully disagree. First, and I was going to say, in addition to context, we rely upon the language itself of Section 7.5, is valid or recognized. We think it's clear, but if someone said, well, but what if? And quite apart from the timeline I was talking about earlier, this very brief window of 4-plus months, and how would, in fact, and I would ask the court, before it comes to a conclusion in this room, to think, how does the draftsperson do her work in drafting the...
Well, let me ask you that. That gets right to the point, I think. Instead of having to rely, with all due respect, on what is the meaning of the word is and so forth, given the fact especially that very substantial reliance and rights are potentially involved here, why was it that there wasn't an express retroactivity clause which would have made it abundantly clear, not just to the electorate, but to courts having to interpret yet another initiative, what the intent was? And let me supply a potential answer, and you will probably disagree with it. Perhaps as a matter of strategy,
political strategy. It was deemed wise not to make it all that clear to the electorate that the marriage ceremonies of thousands of individuals would be invalidated by the passage of Prop 8, because that would lessen the chances of Prop 8 passing, and therefore it was left deliberately ambiguous. And if that's the case, shouldn't the tie go to the runner?
But that non-benign view of the draftsperson's intent does, if I may say so, with all respect, overlook entirely the fact that when the language was drafted and being presented to the literally over 1 million persons, I don't know how many it's presented to, but over 1 million persons signed it, every one of those signatures came on to the signature line when the law of California was the law that previously obtained and now obtains under Section 7.5. So what the court would be saying is the draftsperson should have peered into the future, looked ahead, and even though the Court of Appeal had overturned the Superior Court's decision, and you, of course, know the history perfectly, that was the law at the time. It also was, and this is so clear that what the proposition was seeking to do was simply, and it uses the word restore, to simply restore, I would say simply to continue the law as it had always been until then this Court's opinion on May 15, and then, of course, it became effective in the month of June. All the signature gathering had been done. Those 1 million-plus Californians who had signed on the dotted line did so when the law of the jurisdiction was only marriage between a man and a woman is valid in California.
Apart from the initiative drafters' intent and rules of statutory construction with respect to the issue of retroactivity, could you address a due process quasi-ex post facto issue that is a constitutional issue as to why it would be fair or not fair to invalidate those marriages?
Yes, and again, I'm not trying to quibble, but we do think there's not an invalidation ad initio. Honoring those, it was legally entered into at the time, but it is no longer valid or recognized. This court has taught us much about the distinction between so-called primary retroactivity and secondary retroactivity. And primary retroactivity is really what my colleagues on the other side rely upon, and that is looking at past acts and then increasing the liability. This Court's opinion in the Myers case, the tobacco, the smokers case, you know your jurisprudence well in this area. You've developed an enormous amount of jurisprudence, illuminating the path with respect to what retroactivity is permitted. And what is, in fact, permitted, raising no constitutional questions, is so-called secondary retroactivity. That is what this is. There is no imposition of liability, but there is, in fact, a changing of the understanding of what marriage is with various ameliorative doctrines like the putative spouse doctrine and the like. And the legislature itself, to come back to Justice Ming's part two of the question, the legislature may look upon the situation and say, I think we need to legislate in this area. There may, in fact, be things that need to be done. But to come back then, if I may, to the fundamental issue, we think that this language is valid or recognized, is quite clear, and if I may, quote, buried in, which Your Honor used twice, I think would carve out a new kind of principle in this Court's jurisprudence.
It's not as clear as marriage whenever performed, or whether performed in the past or henceforth.
True, but recall that what the proposition is doing is simply taking Prop 22, and it's the same language, and everyone knows what's going on. Everyone knows, and indeed there was litigation by my, on the part of some of my colleagues on the other side, with respect to the very language that was, quote, buried in. It wasn't buried. It's in the rebuttal because it is an exchange. And the regardless of when or where performed is fairly strong language.
Star, let me ask you this. It is strong language, but it is preceded by other language. The entire sentence reads that your yes vote on Proposition 8 means only that marriage between a man and a woman will be valid or recognized. That seems to speak of a future tense, then there is a subsequent clause that says regardless of when or where performed, we might have quite an extended discussion about what that modifier really means. It may refer to marriages performed in other states that were valid in those states when they were performed. It may mean many things. But if we can discuss at length and perhaps disagree about what it means, then it's very hard to say that it is so clear that it invokes the retroactive application.
Well, again, we don't think it's retroactive. And this is not lawyers' talk. When you look at most, it's secondary retroactivity. But we think that this is prospective. And what, of course, this is looking at, and this language, of course, is not crafted after the election. It wasn't crafted after the marriage case's decision on May 15th. It was crafted long before.
Right, but it was enacted in its own time, sufficient to the day.
Fair point. But the election, of course, and that's one of the things with respect to the initiative, what we know is the lodestar is not fairness. You may think that this is unfair, and that's a reasonable view.
So you're, you're saying that the will be valid or recognized is the prospective application?
No. I think it is looking, when this language is being put before the community, this kind of language is drafted prior to the time of the change in the law.
But you're still saying that what was valid and recognized on November 3rd is not valid, recognized from November 5th, and so forth, and so on. And isn't it really a bit of leisure demand to say that that's not retroactivity?
Well, I see that my argument has
been doesn't mean will.
I see my argument has been very persuasive in this particular point. But the point I would leave you with is this. On this point, obviously, I'm delighted to continue the colloquy for as long as you would allow me to do that. Is the lodestar, of course, is the intent. What is the intent behind this? Not should we look at this with an overlay of the Chancellor's sense of equity and fairness, very understandable lens, but the key lens we would hope the court would use to examine this language in context of the restoration of 170 years is, here it is.
Valid. But can't you blend the two? You can say that considerations of equity demand that when there's been substantial reliance and substantial rights are involved, the intent of the electorate has to be much clearer than it was here.
Well, that is the prerogative of the court. That is, of course, your judgment, ultimately.
And it
we
turns
don't
think
on that, the that judgment honored. Oh, I'm sorry.
Dean Starr, it does turn on the intent of the electorate,
yes,
as opposed to the intent of the drafters, does it not?
I agree. But the drafters, I could not agree more, and I stand corrected. But the drafters, of course, are mindful of what is it that will be before the voters, and they know through the jurisprudence of this court that it needs to be clear, it needs to be not overly complicated. And so what is the draftsperson to do? And it is a bit of a conundrum. I tried it myself. How do you do that? If the Supreme Court does this, and if it does that, and it becomes more complicated. And one of the things that Justice Mosk taught us all is that please be clear. You're saying you are clear. We think this language is clear, especially if you view it with the backdrop of the 170 years of context and the restoration. And then the language, which we have now had a colloquy over, so I'm burdening the court with repeating myself, but it does seem to us that regardless of when or where performed is pretty plain English.
But that's not in the measure itself. It's in one of the arguments.
That is correct. But this court will look. If it finds ambiguity, we don't think that you should find ambiguity, but if the court, using its considerable abilities, finds ambiguity, then, of course, the court, under its jurisprudence, looks to the voter information guide. And we think the reasonable reader, the reasonably informed, yes, we have to assume that this is, in fact, before the voters and that the voters have informed themselves, or otherwise we live in a nihilistic world. The voters are charged with this information, and the dutiful voter, especially on an issue that was, in fact, arresting the attention of the people of the nation, as well as the electorate here, And we can see from just looking at the polls, and so this was an issue that was very, very carefully discussed and debated by the polity. And we think when you take context, language of the proposition, Section 7.5, and now the language of the voter information guide, the intent of the voters becomes quite clear. But you have the assurance that there are ameliorative doctrines, both statutory and equitable, that will achieve these values of fairness that are of concern to the court. I thank the court for its time, but I would be delighted to answer any other questions. The court's been very indulgent.
We may have run out of questions, Mr. Starr. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll proceed now by way of rebuttal, and we'll be hearing from Mr. Minter first, then Mr. Morocco, and then Ms. Stewart. All right.
Thank you very much. Your Honors, I would like to focus on an important missing link between popular sovereignty and equal protection that's been absent from this conversation, but I think it's critical to petitioner's argument. Popular sovereignty is legitimate only under conditions of formal equality, only where all people have the right to participate equally in society and in the political process. And that is why this Court's enforcement of equal protection to prohibit discrimination on suspect bases is qualitatively, structurally unique. Because that is the circumstance where we know it's established that we cannot trust the normal political process to operate adequately or fairly because of systemic distortion by very historically entrenched patterns of discrimination. So when the court enforces equal protection to prohibit government discrimination against groups defined by suspect classifications, it is protecting the legitimacy of the democratic process itself.
Did Proposition 8 completely abrogate the holdings that the majority of this court articulated last year in the marriage cases?
It obliterated the essence of the court's holding, which is that same-sex couples are entitled to have equal dignity and respect, to have the same official family official state recognition of their family relationship as opposite-sex couples. That equality...
Would you agree or disagree with the observation that what Prop 8 did, and I think that Mr. Starr also acknowledged that, Prop 8 did not take away the whole bundle of rights, very important rights, that this court articulated in the marriage cases. What Prop 8 did is take away the label of marriage and its applicability to same-sex couples, but left intact are the court's holding in the marriage cases that sexual orientation is a suspect classification, in my view, a very important holding. And to use a term that Justice Baxter mentioned earlier, the majority constitutionalized the domestic partnership aspect. Is it still your view that the sky has fallen in as a result of Proposition 8 and that gays and lesbians are left with nothing?
The very serious constitutional and human harms that this court found in the marriage case as a result of the exclusion of same-sex couples and their family from the same equal recognition, equal respect, equal dignity will not go away as a result of Proposition 8. They will be exacerbated.
Assuming that, just for purposes of oral argument, that this court were to uphold Proposition 8, presumably your side, just like the other side has had, you have the right to go to the people and present an initiative to the people some years from now. Wouldn't you have that right?
Same-sex couples and their families would be put in the untenable position of doing that from a position as formal constitutional outsiders, as the only group of citizens in this state who have been singled out facially by our state constitution and put into a class in order to make them unequal to everyone else with respect to a right that Mr. Starr rightly described as profoundly important, foundational.
Well, Mr. Minter, to follow up on Justice Kennard's question, I find it remarkable that you are taking the position that if you lose with regard to the validity of Proposition 8, you are conceding far greater impact and effect of Proposition 8 in removing rights extended to same-sex couples than does Mr. Starr, who gives it, I think, by way of appropriate concession, a more limited interpretation in terms of the proposition eliminating the designation of marriage, eliminating the nomenclature, but not disturbing the court's recognition of very important rights, which Justice Kennard's question illuminated. I find that somewhat remarkable, at least to the point where I'd like to have your gloss on it. Now, as a matter of strategy, of course, it assists your argument that this is a provision and not merely an amendment to, in effect, as Justice Kennard's words used it, say that the sky is falling in. But don't you view the scope of Proposition 8 as taking much more or taking much less away from what was established in the marriage cases than you just intimated a moment ago?
There's nothing strategic about the impact of a decision upholding Prop 8 will have on the lives of tens of thousands of same-sex couples and their children and their family in this state. The court found before that being relegated to a different status, legal status, having their family singled out on the basis of a characteristic with no relationship to their ability to participate in family life and marriage in the community, marks them as second-class citizens, works a real and appreciable harm, particularly on the children of same-sex couples. Those harms will now be exacerbated exponentially by having that outsider status enshrined in our state constitution.
All right. Thank you. Your time is up, and we'll hear now from Mr. Morocco.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to, if I may, just follow up on Justice Kennard and Justice George's questions of Mr. Minter. Aren't we basically just focusing on a very narrow aspect of Prop 8, which has changed the nomenclature, but the basic suspect class expansion of rights, which was the core of the case, stays? That's the position. And I'm listening to Mr. Starr, and what really, I think, is, you know, impressed me as I heard him, he didn't call it Prop 8. He called it Article 1, Section 7.5, because now it's in the Constitution. Not prop. We should call it article. It's part of our Constitution now. So I'm proposing hypotheticals. We've all been talking about hypotheticals. This is a realistic hypothetical. Article 1, Section 7.6, which will be called, I'll call it Prop 8 next year, comes up and says, keeping in mind Saylor in versus Kirby, which I don't think we discussed much this morning, that was also a unique case, first case of first impression, way before any other state, back in the 60s. Saying that, as we all know, that a bartender has to be a man, can't have a woman bar, basically simplifying it. And this court said then that gender is a suspect class, just like sexual orientation is a suspect class in our marriage case. So it's a very similar idea, novel at the time. Okay. So our Proposition 8A next year says what? Only 2 points, 8A and 8B. They're both on the ballot. One will be substantive, one will be nomenclature. Nomenclature. Only males shall serve as members of the California judiciary. Females shall be commissioners with the same rights and powers as men. Okay, people. The people have the sovereign people. 51% passed it, 52% passed that. They have reasons. Many women get pregnant, they'll be off the bench, they won't be, whatever their reasoning is. Women will be commissioners, call commissioners, same rights. Justice Corrigan, Justice Kennard, Justice Werdiger, you can rule the same way, but you're called a commissioner. Justice Moreno is not. It's called a judge. Justice. Okay, it's nomenclature. Well, what's the problem? Pretty, what is the problem? You wouldn't care. Nobody would care. It's a name. It's a name. You have the same rights.
Just as potent an illustration was given at the oral argument in the marriage cases when Ms. Stewart spoke in terms of Perez v. Sharp and asked whether the court would have come out the same way if unions between various racial minorities and majority members should be called the trans-racial unions. Would that pass muster?
Correct.
And, of course, our opinion in the marriage cases rejected that under application of the state constitution. Today we have a different state constitution, however, don't we?
But that what we would be proposing, our clients, the Tyler clients, would be proposing is going back to what Justice Werdiger said and Justice N. Corrigan, I think, said, that we never had a case like this. Court has never addressed an issue like this on revision versus amendment. It never had a fundamental right. The fundamental right of gender discrimination has never, in this context I just gave, has not been before the court.
I understand.
Thank you, Justice Moreno.
Yes, Justice Clark.
Mr. Verrocco, the various counsel notified us in writing as to which issues they would focus on. You were the only counsel who said
separation of powers as well.
Oh, no, I don't want to discuss separation of powers. You were the only attorney who said that you would be arguing retroactivity. And as I articulated earlier, I was surprised to see that only you would do that. In my view, it is a very important issue, hence this question. I asked several questions of Mr. Starr on that issue. And you may recall that at one point I asked Mr. Starr, if we were to agree with you, would there be a violation of the contract clause or the due process clause of the federal constitution? And as I recall, Mr. Starr quickly responded, no, he saw no problem. After all, there is the doctrine or theory or whatever one wants to call it pertaining to putative spouses, or the availability of domestic partnership. Now, from your standpoint, if we were to agree with Mr. Starr that the marriages that were performed before the voters' enactment of Proposition 8, do you see a problem with the contract clause?
Yes, 100%.
Or vested rights?
100%. The court.
All right, the answer is yes. Now we get to the question, the answer by Mr. Starr, no problem, because of the existence of the putative spouse theory and the fact that there still is the availability of domestic partnership. In your view, is that sufficient to avoid an unconstitutional impairment of vested rights?
You may respond, but your time is up.
No, Your Honor. The court ruled that way in Fabian and Buell, the Supreme Court, in 4800.1 of the Family Code and 4800.2 in the Family Code, which prospectively said that certain vested rights were no longer of transmutation and mainly transmutation and reimbursement claims would apply going forward. The court said that has to be prospective because you're taking away certain reliances that a married couple had when they were living together.
Thank you, Mr.
Just one last point in answer. Probably, maybe the reason that I was the only one who listed retroactivity on my response was we were hopeful that we wouldn't get to that because it would be a moot point if the court struck down Prop 8. So that's probably why I'm the only one who did that.
Thank you, Mr. Morocco. And we'll hear now from Ms. Stewart.
Ms. Stewart, I have a question I didn't even get a chance to ask, so I want to get my foot in the door. I want to make sure I understand your argument on the constitutional structure. And if I'm wrong, I need you to correct me. I understood your argument to redound to this, that when the people enacted the Constitution and included an equal protection clause in it, the people gave to the courts the power to expand our understanding of what equal protection means, even when the people themselves might object.
Is that your position?
Your Honor, the people gave the court the power to interpret all of the constitutional principles and to give them meaning as, over time. What my argument is that when they enacted also, they placed restraints upon themselves in the process that can be used to change the Constitution. And in interpreting where the line between revisions to the Constitution lie and amendments lie, the court has to look back to core principles and whether it alters core principles.
All right, so my formulation would not be quite as broad. You would not agree to quite that broad an interpretation, but you would understand it in the context of your argument with regard to revision.
Correct,
and
Your Honor.
Amendment. Thank you.
Ms. Stewart, I want to follow up on a question I wanted to ask Mr. Morocco, and it may be unfair, but I think you can handle it. I think the point that he was making, Perez, which was decided in 1948, was based on federal constitutional grounds, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Sailor Inn, I think, is relies upon both state constitution and federal constitutional grounds. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that if we eliminated the protection of the federal constitution, the hypothetical that Mr. Morocco was pointing out about commissioners versus justices, is it your belief that under Dean Starr's argument that that kind of amendment properly passed would pass California constitutional muster?
Yes, and Mr. Starr, my esteemed colleague, he conceded that a ruling that Proposition 8 is a valid amendment would mean that the California Constitution places no limit whatsoever on the kind of discrimination that can be inflicted through the ballot box. If an initiative measure prevented lesbians and gay men promoting
solution,
property.
Is the solution to change the process by which the California Constitution so readily has been amended more than 500 times since 1879, or is it for this court to limit the people's power to amend the Constitution by way of the initiative process?
Your Honor, the issue here is not about the court limiting the people's power. The issue is about whether the court will honor a limitation that the people placed on themselves when they enacted our Constitution. And that limitation was the distinction between major changes to fundamental principles in the Constitution and minor changes that better carry out the Constitution's purposes. That's what we're here to discuss. And by the way, to require the people to go through the more deliberative process of revision is not something that takes away their sovereignty in any way. In fact,
Ms. Stewart, what do we do with Mr. Starr's comment that this court's jurisprudence has uniformly, and every justice has had the opportunity to speak to it, has unanimously said that a revision is an altering of the basic framework and structure of government?
I would say, as I think Your Honor indicated earlier, this is a case of first impression. The court has addressed certainly structural changes. It has never held that only a structural change constitutes a revision. And as I mentioned earlier, if we go to such great length that the framers intended to protect the structure, we have to ask why. And the structure is there. Separation of powers is there to protect our most fundamental and important rights.
And what in your view, then, would be the new, addressing the problem in this case, the new standard for a revision? I think you've said it, but I'd like to hear it.
It's a narrow rule that we propose that the court reach today, and I don't purport to suggest that it covers every case in the future. I think the court should address the case before it. But the rule would be that if people seek to take a right that's been recognized not only as an inalienable right, but as fundamental within the Liberty Clause of the Constitution, away from a suspect class. That's a situation. Let me just make an analogy here. The court has recognized, and as Justice Kennard said, our framers also recognized, that when the majority takes away rights in a way that don't apply to itself, the normal self-interest that protects us against overly harsh or unfair treatment isn't there. If I don't have to apply a law to myself, I don't have to worry too much about the consequences. So when, in its equal protection jurisprudence, the court sees a law like that and it singles out an historically discriminated against group for unequal treatment or involves the taking away of a fundamental right, then the court applies a kind of heightened scrutiny. And that same reason, that same process issue, the distortion that comes with treating minorities differently, something that, again, Justice Kennard indicated in her concurring opinion in the marriage cases, our framers well understood.
Uh-huh. As I pointed out earlier, I think the problem that a lot of people are the failure on the number of some people to see a distinction between what I said in my concurring opinion in the marriage cases and this particular case, there is quite a difference. In the marriage cases, this court was simply asked to do what it usually does, interpret a statutory provision in the light of a constitutional provision. As we all know, and I won't belabor all the cases that have said so, because this has been articulated by counsel, and I think Mr. Starr has articulated that, we have a body of case law that has talked about amendment slash revision. And here we are dealing with the power of the people, an inalienable right to amend the Constitution as the people desire. This is what the people have done here. So I don't see that because I said what I said, and I'm still with what I said in my concurring opinion in the marriage cases, I stand by it. But this case is different.
Your Honor,
in this case, we're dealing with a limitation. In fact, looking at the trilogy of cases, starting with Lockyer, where this court said that members of the executive do not have the authority nor the power to disagree with a particular statutory provision that they do not like. That is a question for the court. So there is a limitation on the executive. Then this court in the marriage cases dealt with what I would call a limitation on the legislative power. Yes, I realize it was not the legislature that initially came up with this particular provision, or perhaps by now I'm just confusing things, but it could have been the voters. In any event, whether it was originally the legislature or originally the voters that came up with the statutory provision, I think the voters. There, too, we dealt with a limitation on the part of the legislative to do what it wanted to do. In this case, we are again dealing with a limitation. But whereas in Lockyer it was a limitation on the executive, in the marriage cases it was a limitation on the legislative power, here we are dealing with the difficult issue of the power of the people to limit what the judiciary has done in a particular case. So all three cases show the limitations on a particular branch of government.
Justice Kennard, if I might respond, I did not suggest that the court was addressing this case when it wrote the marriage decision, or that Your Honor was. But what Your Honor pointed out in your concurrence was that the framers of our state constitution understood that majorities have a tendency to act in a way that is disregardful of interests of people who they single out for differential treatment. That recognition on the part of the framers must be taken into account in determining whether in drawing the line that the framers drew between a revision and between an amendment, they intended for the more simple, non-deliberative amendment process to be permissible to use in the context of singling out a minority. Now, when you ask this court, and Your Honor in particular, you spoke, I think the word you said was the inalienable right of the people to amend the Constitution as they see fit. I beg to differ. I think the amendment power is a limited power. It is a power that is in the legislative section of our Constitution. It is a reserved legislative power. The people themselves imposed limits. They made a distinction in two types of processes to change the Constitution. This court has always been responsible for deciding where that line falls. It cannot ignore the fundamental principles in the Declaration of Rights part of our Constitution that were the main reason for having a Constitution at all in deciding where that line falls. And I don't think this court's prior cases...
Ms. Stewart, let me ask you a question. By transposing the identical language from Prop 22, the statute, to Proposition 8, have the people made a substantive change in the protections afforded by equal protection and everything we said in the marriage cases simply by moving the language from the statute to the Constitution?
Have they made a...
Is there a difference in what equal protection means?
Yes, they have. They have carved or attempted to carve an exception from equal protection. But the problem is that a guarantee of equality that is subject to exceptions made by a majority is no guarantee at all.
Is it significant, though, with reference to the point you were making right before Justice Moreno's question, that the so-called inalienable rights are not subject to a different standard in terms of the amendment process, and that some states have, and California could, if it wanted to, have a restraint and say that inalienable rights cannot be changed by initiative or can only be changed by a higher vote. But there's nothing in the body of the Constitution that really supports your argument that somehow some parts of the Constitution, in effect, are more equal or more important than others. And in fact, California used to have a procedure whereby it was not as easy to amend the Constitution, and it changed that.
But, Your Honor, as this Court recognized in the McFadden case, the founders drew a line, they made a difference, and they intended it to be a real difference between what kinds of things you can do by revision and what kinds of things you can do by amendment. I would point the Court to the preamble of our Constitution, which states that we, the people of the state, grateful to Almighty God for our freedom, in order to secure and perpetuate its blessings, do establish this Constitution. That tells us a great deal about what the main purpose of our Constitution was. I don't purport to agree with the Attorney General insofar as I would say that the presence of an inalienable fundamental right, the subset of inalienable that is the fundamental rights this Court has found, alone would preclude, could not be changed by amendment. But when you have the intersection of such an important right with treating the majority and minority differently, having the majority pick out a suspect class and in a distorted process whereby they don't have to pay attention to the consequences of the rule because it does not apply to them, our founders would not have allowed that to be done by amendment even under the more rigorous amendment process.
It was harder beforehand to amend the Constitution.
It was, but it was still a distinction that this Court in McFadden said intended to make a difference, and the Court in Livermore recognized that.
All right. What? I'm afraid your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And I want to thank all counsel for their helpful presentations. Thank you, Mr. Minter, Mr. Marshall, Mr. Morocco, Ms. Stewart, Mr. Krueger, and Mr. Starr. The matter is submitted, and we are adjourned.